Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Today we're going back to the trial of the notorious American cult leader Charles Manson, who died at the weekend. In 2012, Chloe Hadjimatheu spoke to Vincent Boglausi, the man who succeeded in prosecuting Charles Manson for murder.
It's spring 1971, and the most high-profile court case in American history to date has just come to an end. Charles Manson has been found guilty of instructing his followers to brutally murder 8 people in Los Angeles. The gory deaths shocked the nation.
I mean, the very thought of young girls dressed in black, armed with sharp knives, entering the homes of total strangers in the middle of the night and mercilessly stabbing them to death, where the victims are screaming out into the night for their lives. It's the nightmarish nature of these murders that terrified so many people.
Vincent Boglausi was the prosecutor in the Manson murder case. The facts were these. In the early hours of Saturday, August the 9th, 1969, Hollywood actress Sharon Tate and 4 other people were murdered at a film star's hideaway on a hillside above Los Angeles. Sharon, the wife of film director Roman Polanski, was 8.5 months pregnant when she was killed. The following night, Leno LaBianca, a supermarket owner who lived 10 miles away, was murdered with his wife Rosemary in their home. At both murder scenes, words scrawled in blood were left on the walls. The crimes struck fear into the hearts of Los Angeles residents.
They were so random. There didn't appear to be any conventional, traditional motive like robbery or burglary or a drug transaction gone bad, just totally at random. And this instilled enormous fear throughout the L.A. Basin, particularly in Bel Air and Beverly Hills, the area where the Tate murders occurred. It didn't just shake Los Angeles, but it shook the entire nation. Because before these murders, no one identified hippies with violence and murder. What did you identify them with? Well, drugs, free love, but not violence and murder. Then the Manson family comes along looking like hippies, living like hippies, but what they were up to, of course, was murder.
The Manson family, as they were known, were not a family at all. They were Charles Manson's followers, most of them young women who'd been living with him on a California ranch.
There's no question that Manson had a certain magnetism and charisma to him and the world in which he moved, i.e. the offbeat, dropout world of the hippie. Kids seemed to naturally gravitate towards him. And within a short period of time, they were following him. Now, to ask me to explain that, I can't. He was a colorful character, of course, with his long hair and the swastika on his forehead.
Charles Manson was a petty criminal, and he'd spent much of his adult life until then in prison. But he had harbored hopes of making it as a rock star. And in 1967, he moved to L.A., where he befriended the drummer for the Beach Boys, Dennis Wilson, who helped Manson record his first track.
Cease to exist. Just come and say you love me. Give up your work. Come on, you can't be.
He was a frustrated singer-guitarist. a pseudo-philosopher, a megalomaniac, but more importantly than anything else, he was a evil, sophisticated con man who cleverly hid behind the common image of a hippie, that of being peace-loving, but he was not peace-loving. He had a passion and a lust for death and murder.
Having failed to make it as a musician, he isolated himself on the ranch, surrounded by his followers. There, Manson developed a twisted philosophy of racism, death, and destruction, inspired, he claimed, by the Beatles.
Helter Skelter, you know, is a title of a Beatles song in the White Album, which Manson played over and over and over again. But to Manson, it was a term that he used to describe the last final destructive war on the face of this earth among men, Armageddon. Manson was a racist, and he believed that blacks were subhuman. He told his family that they could ignite this war by committing these murders and framing the black man. He believed that the black man was going to win this war because he said the black man had been stepped on by the white man for centuries, so now it was their turn to take over. He felt they would never know how to handle the reins of power. They'll have to turn over the reins of power to those white people who had survived Helter Skelter, i.e. Charles Manson and his family. So he viewed himself and his family as the ultimate beneficiaries of this black-white war.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, November 24th, 2017. So I have been told this is our second study session on Kevin Dutton's The Wisdom of Psychopaths. We only got through the preface and chapter one last week. So we're very early in the book. We're starting at the beginning of chapter two. Last week, we had mention of many infamous serial killers, including Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, Charles Manson, who just passed away within the past week. I pointed out last week in the text, Mr. Dutton said that this book, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, is not intended as some sort of celebration of serial killers like Dahmer, cannibal serial killers, and Charles Manson. All I can say is you can look at all of the attention over the past week on Mr. Manson, really the past few decades, movies and books and TV segments, and just wow, it certainly, you could have fooled me. This certainly looks like the worship of another white killer. And as I said last week, and I think it's important, Mr. Dutton, he did not include the racial information. When I say racial information, what you just heard in that audio segment from the BBC about Charles Manson's white supremacist motives with his crimes. And the same thing with Jeffrey Dahmer, him targeting almost exclusively non-white victims. But without further ado, we will go ahead and get started. Again, this is Mr. Kevin Dutton. We're reading his text, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, Lessons in Life from Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers. We are starting on Chapter 2, Context of White Supremacy. This is audio segment number 1.
Chapter 2. Will the real psychopath please step forward? Who in the rainbow can draw the line where the violet tint ends and the orange tint begins? Distinctly we see the difference of the colors, but where exactly does the one first blendingly enter into the other? So with sanity and insanity. Herman Melville. Why done it? There's a story making the rounds on the internet, and it goes like this. While attending her mother's funeral, a woman meets a man she's never seen before. She thinks he's incredible. She believes him to be her soulmate and falls for him instantly. But she never asks for his number, and when the funeral is over, cannot track him down. A few days later, she kills her sister. Why? Take a little time before you answer. Apparently, this simple test can determine whether or not you think like a psychopath. What motive could the woman have for taking her sister's life? Jealousy? She subsequently finds her sister in bed with the man. Revenge. Both possible, but wrong. The answer, assuming you think like a psychopath, is this. Because she was hoping the man would turn up again at her sister's funeral. If this was the solution that you came up with, don't panic. Actually, I lied. Of course it doesn't mean you think like a psychopath. Like a great many things you stumble upon on the internet, this tale contains about as much truth as Bernie Madoff's profit and loss account. Sure, on the face of it, the woman's strategy is certainly psychopathic. There's no disputing that. Cold, ruthless, emotionless, and myopically self-interested. But unfortunately, there's a problem. When I gave this test to some real psychopaths, rapists, murderers, pedophiles, and armed robbers, who'd been properly diagnosed using standardized clinical procedures, guess what happened? Not one of them came up with the follow-up funeral motive. Instead, nearly all of them came up with the romantic rivalry rationale. "I might be nuts," one of them commented, "but I'm certainly not stupid." Scott Lilienfeld is professor of psychology at Emory University in Atlanta, and one of the world's leading experts on psychopaths, or, as he puts it, successful psychopaths, those more likely to make a killing on the stock market than down some dark, trash can-strewn alley. As we tuck into alligator tacos in a deep-fried southern diner just a mile or two from his office, I ask him about the funeral conundrum. What's going on here? What is it about this kind of stuff that gets us so excited? The question hits a nerve. "I think the appeal of items like this lies in their cleanliness," he says. "There's something reassuring in the idea that by asking just the one question, we can somehow unmask the psychopaths in our midst and be able to protect ourselves from them. Unfortunately, however, it just ain't that simple. Sure, we can work out who they are, but it takes more than just the one question. It takes quite a few of them." He's right. Silver bullet questions, which through some fiendish sleight of mind can somehow reveal our true psychological colors, just don't exist in the real world. Personality is far too complex a construct to give up its secrets purely on the basis of a one-off, one-shot parlor game. In fact, experts in the field have risen to the task of firing quite a few bullets down the years, and have only recently considered declaring an empirical ceasefire. The personality hunters. Personality has a long history, or rather, measuring it does. It began in ancient Greece with Hippocrates, 460 to 377 BC, the father of modern medicine. Drawing on the wisdom of earlier traditions still, the celestial calculus of Babylonian astrology, for example, that had ghosted across the Levant from the sages of ancient Egypt and the mystics of Mesopotamia, Hippocrates discerned four distinct temperaments in the canon of human emotions: sanguine, choleric, melancholic, and phlegmatic. After Hippocrates, not a lot happened for 2.5 millennia. Then, in 1952, the British psychologist Hans Eysenck gave the father of modern medicine's ancient taxonomy a new lease on life. Following exhaustive questionnaire analysis and in-depth clinical interviews, Eysenck proposed that human personality comprised two core dimensions, introversion/extroversion and neuroticism/stability, a third, psychoticism, characterized by aggression, impulsiveness, and egocentricity, was added later. These two dimensions, when set out orthogonally, perfectly encapsulated the four classical temperaments originally identified by Hippocrates. The choleric personality, anxious, irritable, mapped onto Eysenck's neurotic extroversion. The melancholic, depressed, introspective, onto neurotic introversion. The sanguine, warm, dynamic, onto emotionally stable extroversion, and the phlegmatic, calm, self-contained, onto emotionally stable introversion. Hippocrates, it appeared, wasn't just the father of modern medicine, but the father of personality. Eysenck's two-stroke model of personality was positively anorexic compared to the gargantuan corpus of traits unearthed by the American psychologist Gordon Allport some 20 years earlier, In line with the so-called lexical hypothesis of personality, which stipulated that all significant character-related terms would, quite literally by definition, be encoded into language, Allport set sail into the deep, wordy waters of Webster's New International Dictionary on a fishing trip. How many personality-related adjectives were out there, he wondered. The answer, it transpired, was quite a few, and he reemerged onto dry land with a haul of nearly 18,000. This list, after junking those descriptions relating to temporary rather than enduring traits, e.g. elated, shamefaced, Allport trimmed down to a more tractable 4,500. But it wasn't until University of Illinois psychologist Raymond Cattell got hold of Allport's list in 1946, at the same time that Eysenck was working on his model, that personality theorists really had something to play with. Eliminating synonyms and introducing some additional items gleaned from laboratory research, Cattell arrived at a word count of 171. Then he got down to business. Using these descriptions to generate rating scales, he handed them out to volunteers. The task was refreshingly simple: to assess their acquaintances based on the tags provided. Analysis revealed a galactic personality structure fiendishly composed of 35 major trait clusters, referred to by Cattell, somewhat esoterically, as the personality sphere. Over the next decade, further refinement, with the aid of first-generation computers and the embryonic sorcery of factor analysis, whittled it down even further to just 16 primary factors. There, Cattell called it a day. Fortunately for occupational psychologists, however, and those now working in the field of human resources, subsequent theorists pressed on. In 1961, two U.S. Air Force researchers, Ernest Toops and Raymond Crystal, succeeded in distilling Cattell's traits into just 5 recurring factors. These they labeled surgency, agreeableness, dependability, emotional stability, and culture. More recently, over the last 20 years or so, the work of Paul Costa and Robert McCrae at the National Institutes of Health has led to the development of a standardized test of personality called the NEO Personality Inventory. Psychologists don't really do consensus if they can help it. But in this case, it's hard to avoid. Openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, think OCEAN or OCEAN, comprise the genome of human personality. And we're all the sum of our parts. We are not numbers, as Patrick McGoohan famously asserted in The Prisoner. Rather, we are a constellation of numbers. Each of us in the infinite algorithmic firmament of personality space has our own unique coordinates depending on precisely where we fall along each of these 5 dimensions, or as they're commonly referred to, the Big 5. Give me 5. To the casual observer, personality presents as continuous and uniform, of course. It's only when sifted through a prism of mathematical scrutiny that it formally degrades into its 5 constituent components. The Big 5, you might say, correspond to those psychologically indivisible primary colors of personality, anchored at either endpoint by polar opposite character traits, a spectrum of identity that innervates us all. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, occupational psychologists have gotten a lot of mileage out of the NEO and other Big 5 personality tests like it. They've handed it out to employees in virtually every profession you can think of to fathom the precise relationship between psychological makeup and success in the workplace. In doing so, they've found a striking connection between how we're wired and where we're hired. Openness to experience has been shown to play an important role in professions in which original thought or emotional intelligence is the order of the day, professions such as consulting, arbitration, and advertising. While individuals scoring lower on this dimension tend to do better in manufacturing or mechanical jobs. Employees scoring medium to high on conscientiousness, too high, and you slip across the border into obsession, compulsion, and perfectionism, tend to excel across the board, the opposite being true for those posting lower scores. Extroverts do well in jobs that require social interaction, while introverts do well in more solitary or reflective professions, such as graphic design and accountancy. Rather like conscientiousness, agreeableness is pretty much a universal facilitator of performance, but shows up particularly prominently in occupations where the emphasis is on teamwork or customer service, like nursing and the armed forces. But unlike conscientiousness, having lower levels of this trait can also come in handy in bruising, cutthroat arenas such as the media, for example, where egos clash and competition for resources, ideas, stories, commissions, is often fierce. Lastly, we have neuroticism, arguably the most precarious of the NEO's five dimensions. While emotional stability and coolness under pressure can sometimes tip the balance in professions where focus and level-headedness have their say, the cockpit and the operating theater being just two cases in point, it should also be remembered that the marriage between neuroticism and creativity is an enduring one. Some of art and literature's greatest offerings down the ages have been mined, not in the shallow waters of the brain's coastal perimeters, but in the deep, uncharted labyrinths of the soul. But if occupational psychologists have uncovered individual differences in temperament based upon models of job performance, axes of personality that code for success in the workplace, how does the psychopath get along? In 2001, Donald Linnem and his colleagues at the University of Kentucky conducted a study to find out, and discovered that their unique personality structure conceals a telltale configuration of traits, as ruthless as it is mesmeric. Linnem asked a group of the world's top psychopathy experts, fellow academics with a proven track record in the field, to rate on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being extremely low, 5 extremely high, how they thought psychopaths measured up on a series of 30 subtraits, the constituent parts of each of the primary dimensions that comprise the Big Five. The experts have the psychopaths just about flatlining when it comes to agreeableness, which is not surprising given that lying, manipulation, callousness, and arrogance are pretty much considered the gold standard of psychopathic traits by most clinicians. Conscientiousness ratings are nothing to write home about either. Impulsivity, lack of long-term goals, and failure to take responsibility are up there, as we'd expect. But notice how competence bucks the trend, a measure of the psychopath's unshakable self-confidence and insouciant disregard for adversity, and how the pattern continues with neuroticism. Anxiety, depression, self-consciousness, and vulnerability barely show up on the radar, which, when combined with strong outputs on extroversion, assertiveness and excitement-seeking, and openness to experience, actions, generates that air of raw, elemental charisma. The picture that emerges is of a profoundly potent yet darkly quicksilver personality, dazzling and remorseless on the one hand, glacial and unpredictable on the other. The picture of a U.S. president? At first, one might think, maybe not. But in 2010, Scott Lilienfeld teamed up with the forensic psychologist Steven Rubenzer and Thomas Faschenbauer, professor of psychology at the Foundation for the Study of Personality and History in Houston, Texas, and helped them analyze some rather interesting data. Back in 2000, Rubenzer and Faschenbauer had sent out the NEO personality inventory to the biographers of every U.S. president in history. It included questions such as, "You should take advantage of others before they do it to you," and "I never feel guilty over hurting people." In total, there were 240 of these items, plus a catch. It wasn't the biographers who were being tested, but their subjects. The biographers, based on their knowledge, had to answer on their subjects' behalf. The results made interesting reading. A number of the U.S. presidents exhibited distinct psychopathic traits, with John F. Kennedy and Bill Clinton leading the charge. Not only that, but just look at how the Roosevelts fare. Some of history's golden boys are up there in the mix. Should we be worried? Should it be cause for concern when the head of the most powerful nation on earth shares, as Jim Currie noted, a significant proportion of his core personality traits with serial killers? Maybe. But to see where Lilienfeld, Rubenzer, and Faschingbauer are coming from with their political personality profiles, we need to dig deeper into precisely what it means to be a psychopath. When personality goes wrong, you need to be very careful when talking about personality disorder. Because everyone's got one, right? So let's get it straight from the start. Personality disorders are not the preserve of those who piss you off, a common misconception among narcissists. Instead, as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders defines them, they are an enduring pattern of inner experience and behavior that deviates markedly from the expectations of the culture of the individual who exhibits it. The key word here is enduring. A personality disorder is not just for Christmas, although Christmas does admittedly bring out the best in them. No, personality disorders are characterized by deeply ingrained, inflexible patterns of thinking, feeling, or relating to others, or by the inability to control or regulate impulses that cause distress or impaired functioning. They may not be exclusive to those who piss you off, but if someone's got one, they will. DSM classifies personality disorders into three distinct clusters. There's odd/eccentric, dramatic/erratic, and anxious/inhibited. And believe you me, they're all there. The cat-infested, crystal-gazing aunt with the tea-cozy hat and the big dangly earrings who thinks her bedroom is teeming with presences, and that the pair across the road are aliens, schizotypal, the bling-toting, permatanned pool attendant who's had so much Botox he makes even Mickey Rourke look normal, narcissistic, and the cleaning lady I once hired who, after three excruciating hours, was still working on the damn bath, for Christ's sake, obsessive-compulsive. I was paying her by the hour, so who was the crazy one there, I wonder? But personality disorders don't just cause trouble in everyday life. They draw a good deal of fire within clinical psychology, too. One bone of contention revolves around the word disorder. With an estimated 14% of the general population diagnosed with one, the question arises as to whether, in fact, we should be calling them disorders at all. Might not, in reality, personalities be a better description? Well, maybe. But perhaps we should ask what personality disorders are exactly. Do they, for instance, comprise a separate archipelago of pathology, adrift off the coast of mainland personality? Or do they, in contrast, form part of the Big Five Peninsula, remote outposts of temperament at its darkest, most storm-battered fringes? Support for this latter anti-separationist view comes from a wide-ranging survey conducted by Lisa Salzman and Andrew Page in 2004. Salzman and Page scoured the clinical literature, studies that looked in turn at the relationship between each of the 10 personality disorders listed in DSM on the one hand and each of the Big Five personality dimensions on the other, and chucked what they found into one big melting pot of data. Analysis revealed that all 10 personality disorders can be accounted for within the framework of the Big Five model, but, crucially, it was an overriding Big Two that did most of the heavy lifting, neuroticism and agreeableness. To illustrate, Salzman and Page found that disorders particularly characterized by emotional distress, e.g. paranoid, schizotypal, borderline, avoidant, and dependent, display strong associations with neuroticism, while those typified by interpersonal difficulties, e.g. paranoid, schizotypal, antisocial, borderline, and narcissistic, fall down, perhaps not surprisingly, on agreeableness. Also implicated, but to a somewhat lesser degree, were the dimensions of extroversion and conscientiousness. Disorders either side of what we might call the socialite-hermit divide, histrionic and narcissistic on one, schizoid, schizotypal, and avoidant on the other, posted, respectively, high and low scorecards on extroversion. Those either side of the easy rider control freak border, antisocial and borderline in one camp versus obsessive compulsive in the other, were similarly bipolar when it came to conscientiousness. The case seems pretty convincing. If the omnipotent Big Five comprise our personality solar system, then the rogue constellation of disorders certainly forms part of the firmament. But where does that leave psychopaths? The mask of sanity. Psychopathy, like personality itself, first appears on the radar in exquisitely mischievous, though wholly unmistakable, form amidst the musings of the ancient Greeks. The philosopher Theophrastus, circa 371 to 287 BC, the successor to Aristotle as head of the Peripatetic school in Athens, delineates in his book, The Characters, a coruscating caseload of 30 moral temperaments. One of the assembled rings several cacophonous bells. The unscrupulous man, Theophrastus laments, will go and borrow more money from a creditor he has never paid. When marketing, he reminds the butcher of some service he has rendered him and, standing near the scales, throws in some meat, if he can, and a soup bone. If he succeeds, so much the better. If not, he will snatch a piece of tripe and go off laughing. And go off laughing he did. But fast forward a couple of thousand years to the early 19th century, and the unscrupulous man returns, this time as one of the key metaphysical players in the debate over free will. Could it possibly be the case, philosophers and physicians conjectured, that certain moral transgressors, certain unconscionable ne'er-do-wells, weren't simply bad, but were in fact, in contrast to other miscreants, possessed of little or no understanding of the consequences of their actions? One of them certainly thought so. In 1801, a French physician by the name of Philippe Pinel scribbled in his notebook the words manie sans délire after looking on in horror as a man coolly, calmly, and collectedly kicked a dog to death in front of him. Later in that same year, Pinel was to compile a meticulous, comprehensive, and to this day, highly accurate account of the syndrome. Not only had the man in question exhibited not the slightest flicker of remorse for his actions, he had also, in most other respects, appeared perfectly sane. He seemed, to coin a phrase that many who have since come into contact with psychopaths concur with, to be mad without being mad, manie sans délire. The Frenchman, it turned out, was not alone in his ponderings. The physician Benjamin Rush, practicing in America in the early 1800s, provides accounts similar to Pinel's of equally abhorrent behaviors and equally untroubled thought processes. To the perpetrators of such actions, Rush accords an innate preternatural moral depravity in which there is probably an original defective organization in those parts of the body which are occupied by the moral faculties of the mind. The will, he continues, might be deranged even in many instances of persons of sound understandings, the will becoming the involuntary vehicle of vicious actions through the instrumentality of the passions. He anticipated modern neuroscience by a couple of hundred years. The neural tsunami of madness need not, in other words, wash apocalyptically up on the crystalline shores of logic. You can be sound of mind and unsound simultaneously. Spool forward a century and a half and across the Atlantic, at the Medical College of Georgia, the American physician Hervey Cleckley provides a more detailed inventory of La Folie Raisonnante. In his book, The Mask of Sanity, published in 1941, Cleckley assembles the following somewhat eclectic identikit of the psychopath. The psychopath, he observes, is an intelligent person characterized by a poverty of emotions, the absence of a sense of shame, egocentricity, superficial charm, lack of guilt, lack of anxiety, immunity to punishment, unpredictability, irresponsibility, manipulativeness, and a transient interpersonal lifestyle. Pretty much the picture that 21st century clinicians have of the disorder today, though with the aid of lab-based research programs and the development of techniques such as EEG and fMRI, we are now beginning to get a better understanding as to why. But interspersed in Cleckley's portrait are brushstrokes of what looks like genius. The psychopath is described as having shrewdness and agility of mind, and talking entertainingly, and possessing extraordinary charm. In a memorable passage, Cleckley describes the innermost workings of the mind of the social chameleons, the day-to-day life behind the icy curtain of unfeeling. The psychopath is unfamiliar with the primary facts or data of what might be called personal values, and is altogether incapable of understanding such matters. It is impossible for him to take even a slight interest in the tragedy or joy or the striving of humanity as presented in serious literature or art. He is also indifferent to all these matters in life itself, beauty and ugliness, except in a very superficial sense, goodness, evil, love, horror, and humor have no actual meaning, no power to move him. He is furthermore lacking in the ability to see that others are moved. It is as though he were colorblind, despite his sharp intelligence, to the aspect of human existence. It cannot be explained to him because there is nothing in his orbit of awareness that can bridge the gap with comparison. He can repeat the words and say glibly that he understands, and there is no way for him to realize that he does not understand. The psychopath, it's been said, gets the words, but not the music, of emotion. I got a distinct taste of what Cleckley was driving at in one of my very first encounters with a psychopath. Joe was 28, better looking than Brad Pitt, and had an IQ of 160. Why he'd felt the need to beat that girl senseless in the parking lot, drive her to the darkness on the edge of that northern town, rape her repeatedly at knife point, then slit her throat and toss her face down in a trash can in a deserted industrial park is beyond comprehension. Parts of her anatomy were later found in his glove compartment. In a soulless, airless interview suite, smelling faintly of antiseptic, I sat across a table from Joe, a million miles and 5 years on from his municipal blue-collar killing field. I was interested in the way he made decisions, the stochastic settings on his brain's moral compass, and I had a secret weapon, a fiendish psychological trick up my sleeve, to find out. I posed him the following dilemma. A brilliant transplant surgeon has 5 patients. Each of the patients is in need of a different organ, and each of them will die without that organ. Unfortunately, there are no organs currently available to perform any of the transplants. A healthy young traveler, just passing through, comes into the doctor's office for a routine checkup. While performing the checkup, the doctor discovers that the young man's organs are compatible with all 5 of his dying patients. Suppose further that were the young man to disappear, no one would suspect the doctor. Would the doctor be right to kill the young man to save his 5 patients? The moral conundrum was first put forward by Judith Jarvis Thompson, the author of The Fat Man and Trolley Experiment we discussed in Chapter 1. Though certainly a talking point, it's pretty easily resolved by most people. It would be morally reprehensible for the doctor to take the young man's life. No physician has the right to kill a patient, irrespective of how humane or compassionate the justification may seem at the time. It would be murder, plain and simple. But what would someone like Joe's take on it be? I can see where the problem lies, he commented matter-of-factly when I put it to him. If all you're doing is simply playing the numbers game, it's a fucking no-brainer, isn't it? You kill the guy and save the other 5. It's utilitarianism on crack. The trick's not to think about it too much. If I was the doctor, I wouldn't give it a second thought. It's five for the price of one, isn't it? Five bits of good news. I mean, what about the families of these guys? Against one piece of bad. That's got to be a bargain, hasn't it? They do emotions by numbers, one forensic psychiatrist told me, as we sat in his office talking about psychopaths. In Joe's case, it would seem, quite literally. Identity crisis. The psychopath's powers of persuasion are incomparable. Their psychological safe-cracking abilities, legendary. And Joe, the killer, the rapist, with his arctic blue stare and genius-level IQ, was certainly no exception to the rule. Sometimes, in fact, when you talk to a psychopath in interview, it can be difficult to believe that there's anything wrong at all, if you don't know any better. Which is just one of the reasons why coming up with a precise classification of the disorder on which everyone is agreed has proven so tricky down the years. It's been 3 decades now since psychopathy got its clinical residence permit. In 1980, Robert Hare, whom we met in Chapter 1, unveiled the Psychopathy Checklist, the inaugural test, and to many still the best, for detecting the presence of the disorder. The checklist, which in 1991 underwent a facelift, it's since been renamed the Psychopathy Checklist Revised, PCLR, comprises a 20-item questionnaire carrying a maximum score of 40 on each item. An individual can score either 0, doesn't apply, 1, applies somewhat, or 2, fully applies, and was developed by Hare on the basis of both his own clinical observations and those previously identified by Hervey Cleckley. Most of us score around 2. The entry level for psychopaths is 27. Perhaps not surprisingly, given the way personality theorists like to do things, the 20 items that make up the PCLR have, on numerous occasions, just like the 240 items that comprise the NEO, been subjected to the statistical card shuffling game that is factor analysis. The results of the game have varied over the years, but recent activity by a number of clinical psychologists suggests that in exactly the same way that there exist 5 main dimensions of personality space in general, there lurk 4 main dimensions in the spectral psychopath nebula nested mercurially within it. Psychopathy, in other words, is a composite disorder consisting of multiple interrelated components that range discreetly and independently along a number of different spectra: interpersonal, emotional, lifestyle, and antisocial, a witch's brew of personality leftovers. But which of these spectra are most important? Is someone who scores high on the antisocial elements of the checklist, for example, and lower, say, on the interpersonal dimension, more or less of a psychopath than someone whose profile is the complete opposite? Questions like these surface quite regularly in the battle for the psychopath psyche, in the empirical and diagnostic combat zones of clinical definition. Take, for instance, DSM's listing of antisocial personality disorder, ASPD, an area of particular strategic importance in the epidemiological conflicts. The official line, as set out by the American Psychiatric Association, is that ASPD and psychopathy are, in fact, synonymous. ASPD is defined as a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others that begins in childhood or early adolescence and continues into adulthood. The individual must be age 18 or over, show evidence of conduct disorder before the age of 15, and present with at least 3 of the following criteria. 1. Failure to conform to social norms with respect to lawful behaviors as indicated by repeatedly performing acts that are grounds for arrest. 2. Deceitfulness, as indicated by repeated lying, use of aliases, or conning others for personal profit or pleasure. 3. Impulsivity or failure to plan ahead. 4. Irritability and aggressiveness, as indicated by repeated physical fights or assaults. 5. reckless disregard for safety of self or others. 6. Consistent irresponsibility, as indicated by repeated failure to sustain consistent work behavior or honor financial obligations. 7. Lack of remorse, as indicated by being indifferent to or rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another. But is this really the same thing as psychopathy? Many theorists argue not, and that although there is certainly overlap between the two, the fundamental difference lies in insidious vagaries of emphasis, in the manifest imbalance between the welter of behavior items, of socially deviant criteria that characterize ASPD, and the core affective impairment, the shadowy emotional twilight redolent of the psychopath. The ramifications, statistical or otherwise, are not without consequence. In prison populations, ASPD is the psychiatric equivalent of the common cold, with as many as 80 to 85% of incarcerated criminals, according to Robert Hare, meeting the requirements for the disorder. Contrast this with just a 20% hit rate for psychopaths. In addition, this 20% minority punches well above its weight. Around 50% of the most serious crimes on record, crimes such as murder and serial rape, for instance, are committed by psychopaths and continue to be committed by psychopaths. Studies comparing the recidivism rates among psychopathic and non-psychopathic prisoners reveal that the former are up to 3 times more likely to reoffend than the latter, within a period of just 1 year. If we factor violence into the equation, the curve gets even steeper. The psychopath emerges as anything up to 5 times more likely to beat, rape, kill, or mutilate his way back behind bars. More accurate is to say that the relationship between ASPD and psychopathy is asymmetrical. For every 4 people diagnosed with ASPD, you may also have a psychopath on your hands. But every individual presenting with psychopathy will also, by default, be presenting with ASPD. Killer difference. To demonstrate a little more clearly, perhaps, the difference between the two syndromes, consider the following 2 case histories. Case 1. Jimmy is a 34-year-old and has been sentenced to life imprisonment for murder. He's always had a short fuse and got involved in a fight in a pub that ended in a fatal head injury. Generally speaking, Jimmy is popular in prison, keeps his nose clean and his head down. First impressions of him are of an immature, happy-go-lucky kind of guy who gets on well with staff and fellow prisoners alike. Jimmy's criminal record, which consists of 6 offenses, began at the age of 17 when he was arrested for shoplifting, though before that, according to his parents, things were already going downhill. A couple of years earlier, when he was 15, Jimmy began drifting into trouble both at home and at school. He started staying out late at night, joined a notorious local gang, lied habitually, got into fights, stole cars, and vandalized property. When he turned 16, Jimmy dropped out of school and began working for a well-known department store, loading trucks. He also began to drink heavily, occasionally stealing from the warehouse to tide him over. He had trouble holding on to his money, and making ends meet frequently posed a challenge, so he started dealing marijuana. A couple of years later, 3 months after his 18th birthday, he wound up on probation and moved in with his girlfriend. After losing his job and subsequently several others, Jimmy found work at a garage. Despite constant arguments over his drinking, drug dealing, and spending habits, his relationship with his girlfriend remained pretty much on track for a while. There were a couple of affairs, but Jimmy put an end to both of them. He felt guilty, he said. And he was also concerned that his girlfriend would find out and leave him. Then the drinking began to spiral out of control. One night, in his local pub, Jimmy got in a fight. The bar staff intervened quickly, and Jimmy was shown the door. Normally, he would have gone quietly, but this time, for some reason, he just couldn't let it go. So he picked up a pool cue and smashed it with so much force it shattered over the other guy's head from behind. A blow, unfortunately, which caused a massive brain hemorrhage. The police arrived, and Jimmy confessed on the spot. At his trial, he pleaded guilty. Case 2. Ian is 38 and is serving a life sentence for murder. One night, he pulled into a motel to get something to eat and ended up shooting the receptionist at point-blank range in order to steal the money from her till. In prison, he's known to be heavily involved in both taking and dealing drugs, plus quite a few other forms of racketeering. He is charming and upbeat to talk to, at least that is to start with. But conversations usually end up taking a violent or sexual turn, a fact not lost on female members of the staff. He's had a number of jobs on the wing since being admitted, but his unreliability, combined with his explosive aggression, often when he fails to get his own way, have led to a checkered employment history. Ask fellow prisoners what they think of him, and most of them admit to a mixture of fear and respect. It's a reputation he enjoys. Ian's criminal record begins at the age of 9, when he stole some computer equipment from his local youth club. It quickly escalated into the attempted murder of a classmate when he was 11. When confronted by Ian in the school lavatories, the boy refused to hand over his dinner money, so Ian put a plastic bag over his head and attempted to suffocate him in one of the cubicles. But for the intervention of a teacher, Ian says, he would have made sure the fat bastard never needed his dinner money again. Recalling the incident, he shakes his head and smiles. On leaving school, Ian spent most of his time checking in and out of various secure units. His criminal proclivities were versatile, to say the least. Deception, shoplifting, burglary, street robbery, grievous bodily harm, arson, drug dealing, pimping. Unable to hold down a job for more than a couple of weeks at a time, he either sponged off friends or lived off the proceeds of his crimes. He enjoyed a transient existence, drifting from sofa to sofa and hostel to hostel, preferring to move around instead of putting down roots. Exuding a confident, charming, and self-assured persona, he could always find someone willing to put a roof over his head, usually some woman he'd chatted up in a bar, but inevitably it ended in tears. Ian has never been married, but has had a string of live-in girlfriends. His longest relationship lasted 6 months, and like all the others, it was peppered with violent rows. On each occasion, it was Ian who moved into his partner's place, rather than the other way round. And on each occasion, he swept them off their feet. Affairs were commonplace. In fact, Ian has trouble remembering a time when he didn't, as he puts it, have more than one chick on the go, though he claims he was never unfaithful. "Most of the time I came back to her at night," he says. "What more do they want?" At his trial, the evidence against Ian was ironclad. Yet he entered a plea of not guilty and still, to this day, maintains his innocence. As the verdict was read out in court, he smiled in the direction of the victim's family and gave the judge the finger as he was escorted from the dock. Since being in prison, Ian has filed 2 appeals against his sentence. He is supremely confident, despite repeated protestations to the contrary from his solicitor, that his case will be reviewed and that the verdict will be overturned. "The champagne's on ice," he says. So you're the clinician, and Ian and Jimmy are cellmates. They're sitting in the corridor awaiting consultation. Do you think you could identify the psychopath out of the two? On the surface, it might be difficult. But let's look again at the criteria for ASPD. Both show a failure to conform to social norms, and both have tendencies toward poor behavioral control, toward impulsivity, aggressiveness, and irresponsibility. A clear-cut diagnosis, I'd suggest. But now let's examine the psychopathic narrative, the need for stimulation and a parasitic lifestyle. More Ian's bag than Jimmy's, I'd suggest. Yet it's when we come to emotion, or more specifically, the lack of it, that Ian's mask of sanity really begins to slip. Charming, grandiose, manipulative, deficient in empathy and guilt, Ian is so good at psychopathy, it's almost as if he's been practicing. as if he's recently come out of some secret psychopath finishing school with honors. ASPD is psychopathy with added emotion. Psychopathy is an emotionless void. Criminal omission. That psychopathy doesn't pass muster with the custodians of DSM is an intriguing act of omission. The reason most cited for its curious and conspicuous exclusion is one of empirical intractability, that and its supposed synonymy with ASPD. Guilt, remorse, and empathy are not perhaps the most quantifiable of constructs to grapple with. So best, instead, to stick to observable behavior, lest the specter of subjectivity rear its head. This is problematic, to say the least. For a start, studies reveal that concordance rates among clinicians are actually pretty high when it comes to the PCLR. The scale, to use the proper terminology, has good inter-rater reliability. And besides, as one senior psychiatrist told me, you can smell a psychopath within seconds of them coming through the door. But that's not the only bone of contention. The enigma of the psychopath's identity, of what precisely the mask of sanity conceals, is given another phenomenological twist by an unnerving observation a little closer to home. Not all psychopaths are behind bars. The majority, it emerges, are out there in the workplace, and some of them, in fact, are doing rather well. These so-called successful psychopaths, like the ones Scott Lilienfeld studies, pose a problem for ASPD and, incidentally, for proponents of the PCLR. A recent study, led by Stephanie Mullen-Sweet at Oklahoma State University, presented attorneys and clinical psychologists with a prototypical description of a psychopath. After reading the profile, the two groups of professionals were put on the spot. Were they, Mullen-Sweet wanted to know, able to call to mind anyone they knew, past or present, who, in their own personal opinion, was befitting of such a description, and who, needless to say, was successful in their given career? If so, could they rate that person's personality on a test of the Big Five? The results made interesting reading. Consistent with expectation, the successful psychopaths, conjured, amongst others, from the worlds of business, academia, and law enforcement, emerged nefarious and unedifying as ever. Just like their unsuccessful counterparts, they were described in general terms as being dishonest, exploitative, low in remorse, minimizing of self-blame, arrogant and shallow. No surprises there. But when it came to the Big Five, the similarity continued. Just as in Donald Linnem's study, where the experts donned their rating caps, the successful psychopaths, like their prototypical alter egos, are portrayed, hypothetically, as being high on dimensions of assertiveness, excitement-seeking, and activity, and low on dimensions of agreeableness, such as altruism, compliance, and modesty. Moreover, with the exception of self-discipline, on which the unsuccessful psychopaths bombed and the successful ones excelled, conscientiousness profiles are also seen to converge, with both groups maxing on competence, order, and achievement striving. All of which begs the question, where does the crucial difference lie? Does the fulcrum of disparity between successful and unsuccessful psychopaths, between presidents and pedophiles, pivot solely around self-discipline? Everything else being equal, such a possibility might actually hold some water. The ability to delay gratification, to put on hold the desire to cut and run, and also, needless to say, to run and cut, might well tip the balance away from criminal activity toward a more structured, less impulsive, less antisocial lifestyle. Except that the question of criminal activity raises issues of its own. In both the revised psychopathy checklist, the PCLR, and the criteria for antisocial personality disorder set out in DSM, criminal versatility and repeatedly performing acts that are grounds for arrest constitute, respectively, core diagnostic determinants of psychopathy. Symptoms, in other words, And yet, as the study by Mullen Sweet illustrates, neither of these items need necessarily apply to the successful branch of the species. It's perfectly possible to be a psychopath and not a criminal. So do successful psychopaths fall short of the real deal? Are they a neuron short of a synapse compared to their more notorious, nefarious namesakes? It's a tricky one to call, but 15 years ago, in an attempt to do just that, one man stepped up to the plate and wound up with me and a mountain of alligator tacos in a diner in downtown Atlanta.
Context of white supremacy. That is the end of the first audio segment. We'll pick up. We're still in chapter 2. We'll be on the subheading, The Low Road Through Psychopathy. If folks have commentary, if you are done with your Black Fridaying and or turkey munching, you can dial in 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you want to join the conversation, but you don't want to use your phone to participate, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyTiny.cc/1race. And that is the number one. Address again, tinyTiny.cc/1race. And that is the number one. When you put that address in, you will see a link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. Click the link. It will open a small window on your screen. Top line, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname, press random keys. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. Same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *61. I will see your hand on the screen and we can get you on the line. If folks have commentary on the first portion of the text, folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. This is Red in Nevada. The notes that I took, I tried to have them in order, but I guess not. When the author, when he was talking about how the different, I guess, top psychologists or psychiatrists, when they were narrowing down the words for personalities or adjectives, I thought that that was interesting in how he said, I don't actually have the quote, but basically, it had something to do, well, it made me think about the personality test and how he basically said, you know, you can have the right people for the right jobs, and how races could actually use, you know, personality tests to make sure that they do have other suspected racists or racists in the jobs that they want them to have. So I thought that was definitely interesting, and it made me think about, well, that's how those tests can be manipulated, and it might not really have anything to do with whether you're a psychopath or not. The other thing that really stuck out to me on page 47 was how he was describing, he was saying that Rush was describing psychopaths, and just some of the adjectives that he used, it made me think about races, how he was basically describing races. And I think, actually don't see where Rush had hit, the innate, I'm not sure what that second word is, moral depravity. And I thought that that was definitely interesting because he goes on to say there's probably an original defect organization in those parts of the body which are accompanied by the moral faculties of the mind. And if racists, if they can, you know, do, you know, practice racism and still be cool, calm, and collected, that kind of, that's what I think about being a psychopath. And then also when he was speaking about the American physician, Harvey, he was also, he also had like the description. The main ones that stuck out to me was the immunity to punishment, the lack of anxiety, lack of guilt, superficial charm, irresponsibility, manipulativeness, things of that nature. And that also makes me think about, once again, you know, racist, especially with them being immune to punishment and just really just the lack of guilt and, you know, the superficial charm, being able to sometimes speak about acting like they're speaking about racism and not really saying anything, and still also, you know, all, I guess somewhat trying to be nice, or I guess to me would be fake. I guess the last thing that I wanted to point out, and how, again, I feel like the author is practicing racism, how he said, well, he's not really trying to make heroes out of these psychopaths. However, when he, on page 48, when he was talking about, I think it was Joe, he started off saying that he was better looking than Brad Pitt, and, you know, he had a high IQ. But it's like, why does that need to be known? You know, why does it matter how somebody looks if they're a psychopath or not? So I just thought that that was another example of him, you know, still practicing racism and still kind of glorifying psychopaths. That's all I wanted to share for now. Thank you.
Right on, Red in Nevada. That word, preternatural, preternatural. Wow, we have that one for Scrabble. That means beyond what is normal or natural. Preternatural. One reason I enjoy having the E version, that's double tap. Got the definition, pronunciation, extra information. Great notes. Other folks who had a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Roz.
Greetings to you, Gus. It's great to hear you and to hear Red. Red, brilliant, just brilliant, brilliant assessments and deductions of his text. I said it last week that he was glorifying them, and I gave a couple of examples where he was doing that in the text, and I think the information you elucidated was just awesome, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate that insight. I wanted to go first to last week because there was something that I didn't get to discuss, but it kind of ties into this week. What I love, Gus, when you played the introduction and you started talking about the fact that when he discussed Jeffrey Dahmer and Charles Manson, he left out their racist proclivities, which I know is a complete act of racism. He's a white male, and he's a psychopath himself, this author. Born of a psychopath, sure was passed on in the genes. Now, it's funny because when I saw the documentary on Jeffrey Dahmer, they had said that one thing that would anger him is if people would call him a racist because he killed and ate more black people than any other group of people that he had killed. And he had said that he didn't kill these people because he hated anyone. He killed them because he wanted to possess them in their entirety. Like, he never wanted them to leave him. So he wanted basically a comatose companion that he could just abuse sexually at his whim, who would never be able to physically leave his presence, which he said was what facilitated him eating them and all the other psychotic things that he had done. And I find it interesting in this book that even in talking about psychopaths and this whole psychopathic understanding from him in this field, that nothing came up about black people in an overt sense. But he did make a statement last week, and this was on page 11. He said, and he does it in a racist way, clandestine and sneaky. He says, as we'll see in chapter 2, there is a spectrum of psychopathy along which each of us has our place, with only a small minority of A-listers resident in the quote-unquote inner city. So when he uses that term inner city, it immediately rings to me that he's saying that there's very few black people that exhibit these traits. He's just using the term inner city as a racist means of referring to black people without saying black people. And that was one thing I wanted to just bring up from last week's reading, because I just found it interesting when you made that relation to him not speaking of the racist proclivities and machinations of Charles Manson and Jeffrey Dahmer, even though he spoke about them in the text. Also, I found it very interesting on page 43, he wrote, the results made interesting reading. A number of U.S. presidents exhibited distinct psychopathic traits, with John F. Kennedy and Bill Clinton leading the charge. Not only that, but just look at how the Roosevelts fare. Some of history's golden boys are up there in the mix. So should we be overly worried? Should it be a cause for concern when the head of the most powerful nation on earth shares, as Jim Corey noted, a significant portion of his core personality traits with serial killers? Maybe. But to see where Lilienfeld, Rubenzer, and Faschingbauer are coming from with their political personality profiles, we need to dig deeper into precisely what it means to be a psychopath. And it just reminds me, because I've been researching Bill Clinton and the whole Clinton criminal empire for a long time and been discussing it on a number of radio shows over the last year, including my own. And there was an article I came across this past summer, that stated that there have been at least 56 people that have been documented to have died from very mysterious circumstances surrounding the Clintons. And all of it had to do with them exposing their criminal activity in Haiti, the $1 billion that they stole and only built 3 houses in Haiti, their criminal behavior in the States, the things that they were doing when Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas, and they just went through his history. They found that there's 56 people, including a white journalist that died that was going to expose Hillary Clinton and what she did in Haiti to steal that money. She just died early this past summer. And the fact that everybody that's related to the Clintons, they never get prosecuted. They never get taken to court. It just, people forget about it. The news stops reporting it, and that's it. So he's exhibiting, in my opinion, psychopathic behavior, because he's killed all these people or had them killed, and all of these people were about to expose his criminal behavior, some potentially willing to testify against him in court and his wife in court if it came to it. And all of these people died, self-inflicted gunshot wounds, all kinds of stuff. They killed the Haitian ambassador in Florida just a couple of months ago that was also going to speak out against the Clintons. So he's a psychopath. And it just, to me, this book is really giving you the blueprint of the way the white mind works for everyday white people. And the more powerful they are, the more intense their psychopathy is, as we're seeing with all of this sexual terrorism that's coming out. On page 46, he wrote, he anticipated modern neuroscience by a couple of hundred years. The neural tsunami of madness need not, in other words, wash apocalyptically upon the crystalline shores of logic. You can be sound of mind and unsound simultaneously. That is the linchpin of white supremacy. They are able to act like they're normal, but they are the most abnormal creatures ever. And what it is that you have to get them outside of a public setting for them to exhibit who they really are. That's why all of the stuff that is exposed about what they do usually comes from hidden cameras. You go to a restaurant, you'll find a guy doing something to somebody's coffee or some female waitress doing something to someone's food. It's on hidden camera. They're not going to do it overtly like we read about in The Delectable Negro, because overt slavery no longer exists in that context anymore. So now it has to be done in secret and clandestine. And that's it right there. Their ability to be sound and unsound, of sound and unsound mind simultaneously. I'm almost done. Where is it? Okay, is that it? That might have been it. Yes, I think that's it for now. So I'll mute my line. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the discussion, because this book is great. And thanks for having us read it at this point. I think it's, like you said, your timing couldn't be more impeccable. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Roz. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Yes, we're here.
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. Mr. Demery Four here. First, I'd like to start out saying that I think the book is constructive because it acquaints us with the mind of a sociopath, and we know collectively that whites has these attributes and demonstrate these symptoms. So with that, I think that what I'm understanding is that the psychopathic syndrome, and it's a dyad of traits. And if you draw a little circle, then what's normal personality in the middle, on the outside, would be those psychopathic traits. And the personality disorders are defined, according to the book, as enduring patterns of inner experience and behavior that deviates markedly from the expectations of the culture of the individual who exhibits it. So the key word being enduring. So a temporary session of, I guess, psychosis wouldn't qualify. This would be something that is permanent. I thought it was interesting about let me say this first, Steve. DSM, Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders, what they did was they had these traits or symptoms or whatever, and they started bring them down, categorizing under certain titles, so that to bring the list down smaller, and it came up with three: the odd, eccentric, the dramatic, erratic, and the anxious or the inhibited. Well, they went on and they came up with the Big Five, and he's using the Big Five to form an analysis of the personality. Now, I don't know if I can find it in the book, but on one of the footnotes, they have a website, and it's Mr. Dutton's website. It's dealing with personality. It's a personality test on his website. Well, I took that test. First, I was wondering, if you're going to do testing and you're going to find that the person is psychopathic, well, what's going to keep them from answering the questions incorrectly and then hiding? They're good at disguising themselves and not being found out. So some of those questions that I knew that would be specifically for a psychopath, well, I answered them, correctly, because I guess a psychopath wouldn't be taking a personality test. So the results of the test was basically that I was average in all of these five, the big five areas. Now, the most important thing about it was at the end of the test, they didn't want to know your name or anything like that, but they did want to know your ethnic background, so-called race. You know, I put black in there, but I started to put white. I wanted to go back and do another test and then say I was white to see what the difference was. But I suspected that since racism, white supremacy affects every area of people activity, that Mr. Dutton's findings, his research, experiments, data, and tests are suspicious because he may be practicing racism, white supremacy. I say this because he uses a lot of names for his references and to bring home points. One of the names, I think one of the female callers read, if I'm not mistaken, mentioned Dr. Benjamin Rush, and we know him from Miss Harriet Washington's book, Medical Apartheid. Dr. Benjamin Rush, so-called father of American psychiatry, believed that black skin was a type of leprosy that he called nigritude, and eliminating black skin would eliminate the chief social and religious argument for enslavement. Because he believed blacks themselves preferred white skin. So now Kenneth Dutton quotes Rush, not to discount all of Mr. Dutton's work, you know, I think it's constructive, but when you use material from known races, and I have to note that Ms. Washington said that Dr. Benjamin Rush was not a racist because he was an abolitionist. Well, we know that abolitionists can be racist also, and that she probably was mistaken in Dr. Rush's account. That was on page 46, The Mask of Insanity. What I want to talk about briefly was the funeral. The woman meets a man, she is her soulmate, and she never asked for his number, but the funeral is over. She don't get a chance to talk to him. She's afraid she won't see him again. But a few days later, she kills her sister. Now, you're supposed to figure out why she would kill her sister. And then it turns out that she would kill her sister so she could see her man would come back to the funeral. And I think that gives us a good idea of what a psychopath, the way his mind works. And like Ross brought up, I thought it was interesting that some of the former presidents would classify as psychopaths. And a lot of physicians and politicians, people, high-power CEOs, all have characteristics of psychopaths. And I plan to check out the documentary on Dharma. Talks about Dharma or whatever that document. And I'll mute my line on that. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. If we have other folks who have a hand up, if we've not heard from you, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy.
Greetings. I wanted to comment on just like a couple of things. I think that there's a little bit of importance, or I place some importance on what these individuals look like. I know that's completely subjective, but I think that there's enough evidence to suggest that there's a correlation between appearance and perhaps psychopathy or some type of, psychopathy. We'll just leave it there. And because I've actually, before reading this book, I don't know how I got on like YouTube and watched good number of videos on psychopaths and whatnot. And there was even this one guy who, like, he really wanted to be a psychopath, but he didn't, like, pass the test or whatever. But there's, with all that charm and charisma, the looks go into it. And I think them looking how they look, them being attractive, although that is subjective, allows them to pass, whereas ugly people don't have it that easy. If you're more attractive, it's easier for you to bypass people's intuitions or their radars or whatever, and you're able to seduce them with your looks. So I definitely think that there's just something there. One of the things that I was struck by with the, I didn't get to actually listen, but I read beforehand, so I don't know how far we got. But with all of the words, like they were going, he was going through the history of how psychopathy came to be, and he talks about, well, the first original thinkers of mental disorder and all this other kind of stuff, and he goes into how it was narrowed down to this many words, and then someone did a study, and they found that these particular characteristics fit into the big five and all this other kind of stuff, like it was a novel thing. And I was just like, well, wait a minute. The way that this works is someone thinks something, then other people think something similar. They reference that work. They fall on that, you know, they take resources from that work, they cite that work, and then they keep going. The new people take the accumulation of the new work plus the old work. They pick and choose what they think is right, and then they build upon it. So then to do that for several steps and then turn around and go back to one of the original and say, well, they fit, that wasn't novel to me. And I felt like that was maybe one of those stupid crazy talk kind of things. Like, I wasn't wowed by that. I was like, well, that just makes sense. If you've been referencing all these people all along and everybody's building on everybody's work, then it only makes sense that this new thing fits within the old thing, which is not novel. And I also thought, like, something I just wanted to point out, and this might be my last thing, because I think other people have commented on quite a few things, is that there's a problem when diagnosing. Well, there's a huge problem in the whole way that they, like, conceptualize the psyche and mental disorders and whatnot. But that, as far as I'm concerned, there's enough evidence to suggest that English is a bastard language, which limits a lot of human possibility and expression and understanding and thought and whatnot. And so then to, like, use these words to try to categorize behavior, it doesn't work. I don't think that it works. And that's why they keep, you know, redoing the model and coming up with these so-called personality tests and whatnot. And I just think that it's so unfortunate that we're so limited by English and so limited, like, and just, I didn't get to, it doesn't matter. We can only think with the words that we have. So if all the words that you have are, like, not of the highest caliber, then of course your thoughts won't be either. And I'm just kind of going through my notes really quick. I don't want to take too long. I think that's where I'll leave it. I was just a little, I focused a bit on the language that's used to describe things. And also the fact that I feel limited by the language that I have to describe this. Because, you know, for them to define a psychopath or psychopathy, I feel like I should just define it completely different. I could just say white. But back to the image thing, if all non-white people are programmed to see white people, whether they're actually attractive or not attractive, to be attractive and to be more attractive than we are, then I think that might be part of what facilitates their ability to perform their racism, but also be psychopaths that we just don't see. Is because, in our deeper than our psyche, there's this idea that they are attractive. But thank you all for listening.
For sure. Appreciate that, Emmy. Grand observations all. If other folks that tuned in, if you have questions or a comment that you want to get in, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-#61 if you would like to chime in. Do not wait till the last minute. Some of the thoughts that I had, the subheading, the personality hunters, where he kind of goes through some of the history of psychology and how people were thinking about human personality. That subheading in and of itself, I think, the personality hunters, everything comes back to violence. It's some form of aggression, violent aggression. even when just talking about the history of how we think about human personality. The next thing, when they talked about, I guess they gave out the scale for people to make their assessment of which fields people that had these high traits of psychopathy, when they listed nursing, customer service, and the armed forces. And these were for people who were on the agreeableness scale. Agreeableness is pretty much a universal facilitator. And it was talking about some of the occupations. I just thought that was interesting. To be agreeable means that you're going to be in the armed services. I guess that could relate to following orders, right? Perhaps. Next, let's see. I think Mr. Demery Four already talked about the enduring pattern of inner experience that's in the DSM-4 for personality disorders. And it just reminded me of the disorder and dysfunction with regards to enduring disorder and dysfunction with regards to how whites relate to black people. Again, the metaphors of using darkness, where he says fight, in contrast, form part of the Big Five Peninsula, remote outposts of the temperament at its darkest, most storm-battered fringes. Again, darkness being associated with these psychosis and psychopathy. And he's really only mentioned white people. It's not whiteness associated with that darkness. I thought it was great when he included the anecdote about the unscrupulous man, and he gets to the end and talks about if he gets caught trying to, you know, exploit these different folks at the market, he'll just laugh about it and, you know, continue on with his scheme, and enjoying abusing other people. I think that's really important. I think that's something that we talked about a lot before in the program, where racists, they often brag about practicing racism. It's not enough just to mistreat someone, it's to have fun. Like, this is really supposed to be an activity full of zeal and enjoyment. Yes, we get to, you know, abuse and terrorize the niggers. Yes, the racist jokes, talked about that for so long. Continuing, I thought it just really stood out to me that one of the, I guess, seminal moments in the history of, you know, human psychology and how they're analyzing all of this, when they are thinking about this concept of the man being mad without being mad and not having any emotion or remorse about any of this. It's not a lack of empathy to other people. It's a lack of empathy to a hound. Reminded of Dr. Welsing again, Romulus and Remus brought that up last week. So glad to hear Mr. Demery Four reference Benjamin Rush. We did indeed talk about him during medical apartheid. Harriet Washington did indeed speak highly of Mr. Rush as an abolitionist. I even paused while we were going along with the audio to go back because Vernelia Randall, she's been a guest on the program repeatedly. She also wrote about Benjamin Rush, and she talked about him on her first visit almost a decade ago. And she was saying that people will talk about that. Yes, Benjamin Rush, he's an abolitionist and he spoke out against slavery. And she said specifically, we make that error frequently in seeing a white person do these things and thinking that, oh, yeah, they have our best interest at heart. They do not. They have a hidden white supremacist agenda. And she talked about exactly what Mr. Demery Four pinpointed. And she put him in the class of white racist physicians who made it their point, putting on that white lab coat, to talk about and put out scientific doctrine that says, yes, niggers are subhuman. They're not like the rest of us. So, you know, feel free to use and abuse them as you see fit. Even if, you know, I may say that we don't want them in shackles. We'll just figure out a different way to operate the plantation. Thought that was really important. And that goes back to the same trend of Mr. Dutton mentioning these people who have, I mean, flagrant, this is not they made an offhand racist comment one day, but I mean, substantial part of their body of work is about racism, white supremacy explicitly, and that's totally ignored. To have that happen repeatedly, and again, I don't think he's ignorant. Mr. Dutton is a professor at Oxford. That is, you know, one of the most, many people say that is the most elite white institution on the planet. So this is not an ignorant white man, I just have to chalk these up to acts of white supremacy, leaving this information out. Let's see. I thought it was great. I think read in Ohio, she talked about the point when he's given these anecdotes about Joe and these different killers and psychopaths. He starts off with this guy being better looking than Brad Pitt. Again, white beauty is identified as the standard, not, you know, Denzel Washington or President Obama. Brad Pitt is the standard of beauty, and he's intelligent, and his intelligence is quantified. His IQ is 160. You know, we want to tell you exactly. And he refers to a different one of these white killers, psychopaths, as a genius later on. And that stuck out to me because I remember when Jennifer Eberhardt, she is a black professor at Stanford University. She's done tons of work on racism and how anti-black racism specifically, and how whites, they reflexively almost associate black people with apes. She's done lots of great work. She got a MacArthur grant, and they referred to her as a genius, but they put it in quotes. Like, we don't want to say just, bam, stamp this, you know, negress at Stanford as a genius. So we'll put it in quotes that she's a quote unquote genius with the MacArthur grant. I thought about that in contrast to this. These killers in the book, like, they don't have any quotes up like, oh, yeah, these folks are geniuses. They are the smartest people on the planet, best looking. And oh, yeah, they, you know, happen to kill and eat a few people here and there. Continuing. And literally where he says the same guy, after he's better looking than Brad Pitt and got this IQ, has parts of her anatomy found in the glove compartment. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. When he talked about the professor who came up, I guess, Judith Jarvis Thompson. This is the professor that came up with the experiment. Okay, we'll ask the psychopaths, if you were a doctor and you had five different patients who needed organs, medical apartheid, you had five different patients who needed organs, and you got this guy here, and he's got five compatible organs, do you kill him to save the five? What do you do? The person, Judith Jarvis Thompson, who came up with that study, is the same person who came up with the study about, if you have a train and it can't stop, do you shove the fat guy off the bridge, killing him, but he'll cover the tracks and that'll save the people further down the track. It'll save like 5 or 10 people further down the track from being killed. Judith Jarvis Thompson thought of both of those experiments. Now, I am not a genius. No one has ever called me a genius, quotes or no quotes, but I find that fascinating that you have presumably whites, a white woman, no less. That's your job, much less your job, not make it sound like McDonald's. You are a professor. You're a researcher. That is your research field. You get to sit around, presume maybe even as a think tank. I'm sure she doesn't do this by herself. You get to sit around and think about hypothetical experiments about killing people. Do you kill one person? Do we kill five people? That's your job. We just sit around and think hypothetically about killing people and how other people think about killing people. That is amazing. That's not even the correct word. I find that beyond amazing that people get paid to do that, that the system of white supremacy, that Edwin Williams, counterracism.com, he said years ago that you have certain jobs where he's been told they don't hire sane people for this job because a sane person would not do this. How can that qualify as saying, this is what I do? This is my research profession. I sit around and think of hypothetical scenarios about killing people and what other people think about killing people. That's what I do. What it means to be white. I thought of Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, when he made all of those Neil Postman, when he made all of his objections about George Jackson and the minimizing and making it seem like he didn't really do any crimes and all of this. And he said that we need to be careful with that sort of thing. When Kevin Dutton, when he says killer difference, and he's talking about Jimmy, and he says Jimmy began drifting into trouble both at home and at school. He started staying out late at night, joined a notorious local gang, lied habitually, got in a fight, stole cars, blah, blah, blah. And it just goes on. To me, that doesn't sound like drifting. I've noted that in the language. Whites tend to make white criminality, white terrorism, they make it a very passive act. It's never that whites just decided consciously to go out and terrorize and do these things. It's they drifted somehow. It just happened. And be very, very careful about that. That is a tendency that apparently is a worldwide thing because Kevin Dutton is not even a United States author. Last thing I'll get in, another advantage to having the ebook version, you can just click all those links. When he was talking about the presidents, that link that is linked in the ebook, so I clicked it to check it out, and they have the scale. I'll just read the last paragraph. It says, in the table below, the numbers in the right-hand column refer to the average ranking position of each president across the psychopathic personality index dimensions. John F. Kennedy, for example, was ranked second highest out of 42 on the fearless dominance dimension and sixth highest on the impulsive antisociality dimension, which equates to an average rank of 4 across both scales. Bill Clinton, also with an overall average ranking of 4, came in seventh highest on fearless dominance, but enjoyed top billing when it came to impulse antisociality. Now, I guess some people could be thinking of his rumored sexual escapades over the years. That certainly may qualify. I was thinking of some of his acts of racism, particularly I was thinking about when his wife was on the campaign trail last year and he was confronted, I believe, in Pennsylvania by Black attempted counter racists, and they were calling him to question about his crime bill and what have you from the 90s. And he got an attitude and lashed out at them. That right there strikes me as impulsivity, antisociality, act of racism for sure. But who are you to come in here and question me? These niggers are out of control. We're in, I think, Philadelphia specifically where they were, to come in here, accuse me and talk bad about what I did 20 years ago. And then he went on his rampage. That right there might qualify. I will post the link if people want to check out the scale. I also thought it was interesting that this was done just before that other nigger got to the White House. So President Obama is not on this list. I was very curious to see where he would have fallen on the scale, but this was done before he was there, so he's not included. Do we have any other folks who had commentary they wanted to get in before we get to the second audio segment? Anything else folks want to get in?
Yes, man, Gus, you just really elucidated a lot of brilliant information. Thank you for your insight too. One thing I was going to say is one of the ways you can see how white people's psychopathy and black people's confusion as victims of this system works is they had interviewed Jeffrey Dahmer's neighbor, the black female who lived directly across the hall from him as he was on his killing spree. This is in the same building he was caught in. And she said, and I quote, "I knew Jeffrey, that Dahmer guy is somebody else." And it speaks to how we're taught to compartmentalize white people and always look for the good white person. When white people see us holistically, they see us all the same, but we're taught to see them as individuals. And she even split his personality into Jeffrey, the neighbor who she was friendly with, and the Dahmer guy who the police came to arrest. Also, when Emmy said she was discussing the role that looks play, that is essential in my opinion. I think that's great. You talked about it too, Gus, because white people have created white avatar archetypes, which are proverbially handsome white people. And even in white society, better looking whites get more done. And better looking whites, it's easier for them to get past security checkpoints and all kinds of things. Ugly white people get stopped a lot more and questioned more because they're ugly. So I think that is very essential in the way that they practice white supremacy. And I thought that was a great insight. Also, what you just talked about in regards to them talking about he fell into criminality, or he drifted into criminality. It implies that it's something that's out of their control. It's just something that happened. Just like when they say, "I fell in love," it was out of my control. But yet when it comes to black people, we're just diabolical. If we do anything that is similar to something that a white person did, where the black person's in jail for a number of years and the white person gets to walk. So I thought that was a great insight that you brought up as well. Also, I wanted to just speak from a personal standpoint. because I realized just reading this book and listening to everyone speak that there was something that I personally picked up from white psychopaths when I ran the streets. And one of those things I used to do is I would be very nice, very personable in my approach to some of my victims. And then I would just unleash on them. So it would go from, you know, do you know what time it is, to I'm right up on you, you know, getting what I need to get. And that is something that I picked up from watching white movies, from watching white people and how they function. I've seen them do that stuff, but never as a child associated it with psychopathy, sociopathy, or white supremacy at that point. And I was able to just go through the annals of my mind and say, well, that behavior wasn't something that was inherent in me. It was something that I picked up from watching white people. So I just wanted to just put that personal anecdote out there. I've never really discussed that about myself, but it was just something that I felt was essential because there might be other black people that have done similar things or worse things than I did. And they might not be able to really identify where did I get that from. And just this discussion tonight helped me to understand you got that from white folks. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say really quick, I actually was going to bring it up last week, but I have the hard copy book. It's the first edition. And on the inside book jacket, he has like this little, I guess, description of what the book is supposed to be about. And the last sentence really stuck out to me. It says it's provocative at every turn. The Wisdom of Psychopaths is a riveting adventure which reveals that it's our often much maligned dark side that conceals the trump card of success. So not only in that sentence that, once again, he's using like dark is bad, but also the trump card of success, which I thought was really, really telling, especially for the administration that we currently have. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Indeed. This book was published in 2012. Just a side note, I have the ebook. It is slightly different, and I mean very slight. Like it's about 99.1% in line with the audiobook. It'll just be a slight change every now and then. It's so minute it would be a difficulty for me to point it out. I have to write down an exact sentence from the audiobook to show it's just a slight change. And I think some of that could be, I think this book, because he's in England, I think this book might have been published again for an American audience. And so I think they made like just some slight alterations in the text, what they published for the States and what originally got published for the UK audience. Anything else folks want to get in?
May I say something else as well? Just on that same note, like I said, I have it says the first edition that was copywritten in 2012. It's the same thing. And I was actually, I wasn't really going to point it out, but I did see like on page 36 where he was talking about, I think it was the last part of the sentence of the first paragraph, the father of Western medicine, but of human nature too. And mine says, I think in the audio, it said personality, but in the book it says human nature. And I think and there was a couple other things, just slight differences. Thank you.
I thought that was really important as well. One of the subheadings, the mask of sanity. I think that's really important with regards to racist man, racist woman, racist child. If you want to, any way that you want to think of it, I know some people say you do not think of whites as people. So if you want to think of that as the mask of humanity, but I think that is an integral part of master deceivers. I think that's just a huge part of their package. And I think they're very successful at being able to mimic those emotions, or they know what to say. I think as he said, like he had a interesting metaphor about music. It was almost, I think it was like, you know, the lyrics, you can hear the song. I won't botch it, but it was an interesting metaphor as it relates to music. But whites are very, very skilled at that. And I think frequently
non-white people, victims of racism. That's how they take advantage of us. They're able to trick us. That's a lot of what he talked about here. People, psychopaths being very skilled, being able to manipulate people, being able to trick people, lying, being deceitful, to take advantage of someone. Whites are the best in the known universe at that. Just to really be mindful. Slick Willie. He could be beguiling when he wanted to. And then when you ask a question or two, he's about five. If you see that video footage from Pennsylvania, he looked like he was about 5 seconds away from calling someone a nigger for their conduct and just asking him questions and calling him out on his record when he was president. Anything else folks want to get in before we get to the second audio segment? Greetings to Mel, narrator from our previous audio book.
Yes. You made me think of the line that Ben Tillman had, that if you scratch the surface of the white American, you'll find that roving savage from the steppes of Europe, of Britain. Made me think of that. And also when you talked about the lady who developed the test, the different, I call it Lord of the Flies test. You decide on who's to kill and what's the best way of saving a group of people by killing someone. That whole thing, like you said, you have to think of the psychology, the psychological makeup of the person who is thinking that stuff. And it goes right into entertainment. Look at Quentin Tarantino's films, Stephen King. These, and I just was watching a really interesting, and it came across and gave me a great counter-racist information, but it's called The Secret History of Comics. And in it, they were discussing Superman, and this lady was saying in the documentary that when an artist creates something, there is always a piece of truth, a piece of themselves in their work. So when you're looking at people who create these diabolical psychotic films with all this blood and gore and just creative ways of killing people and torturing them, that is who those people really are. And the reason that they're not doing it in real life is because they have the creative outlet of Hollywood to facilitate their psychotic machinations. And then they do it behind the scenes. And then we hear about Harvey Weinstein 30 years later. Thank you. I mute my line.
Absolutely. That's one quick thing I was going to get into when he was talking towards the end. They were talking about what's the difference between the quote unquote successful psychopaths and the ones that go to jail. Is that the difference? Who goes to jail? Who doesn't? Sometimes the difference can be, you know, who gets caught with whatever it is you're doing. As we've seen with the Weinstein thing, I've even heard, I think, some of the reports that George H.W. Bush was also accused of some sort of sexual misconduct. So a lot of times it could come down to who gets caught. When do you get caught? Andrew Jackson owned slaves. He enslaved black people. That, in my view, would qualify. Who gets classified as a criminal? When do you get classified as a criminal? A lot of it could come down to that. You have a lot of white psychopaths who are doing everything that the white people that are in jail are doing. They just didn't get caught, or they had enough money to make sure that they didn't have to serve any, you know, take any punitive consequences for their conduct. And we have anybody last thought they wanted to get in? We have about a minute before we get to the second audio segment. Anything you can get in quickly?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Really quick, I don't believe it's this author. There's another one. He's on YouTube. His name is Sam Vaknin, I believe. Yeah, V-A-K-N-I-N. And he put out like a couple videos talking about President Obama as a narcissist, but like a psychopath too. So I don't, just because I know you mentioned it about not President Obama not making it in this edition, but there is another person talking about this stuff that has said that President Obama is a narcissistic psychopath. Mm-hmm. That was all.
Appreciate that, Emmy. I can again flex on the cow, Sam Vaknin, guest on The Context of White Supremacy. We had him live from Macedonia. We talked about that exactly. He was very passionate in his conviction that President Obama is the largest narcissist in the history of life. And after we had him on the program, he wrote Gus an extensive letter talking about how impressed he was with our application of his concepts of psychopathy and how we applied that to racism, white supremacy. And he thought it was one of the most fascinating interviews that he did, which was even more startling because I thought this guy is, woo. But yeah, you can go back in the archives. I'll probably play intro. I'll probably play a small segment from that broadcast in one of the intros as we proceed through the book. But yeah, Sam Vaknin
on the cows. With that, we'll get to the second audio segment. We are picking up on the subheading, The Low Road Through Psychopathy. It's in Chapter 2, The Low Road Through Psychopathy. If you have other comments that you want to get in, just make a note. We'll have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. Context of White Supremacy, this is Kevin Dutton, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, audio segment number 2.
The Low Road Through Psychopathy. In 1996, Scott Lilienfeld and his collaborator Brian Andrews were in the process of grappling with exactly this conundrum. As an experienced researcher in the field, with quite a few psychopaths already under his belt, Lilienfeld had come to a definitive, if perplexing, conclusion. Insofar as the inaugural constitution of the disorder was concerned, the traditional concept of what it really meant to be a psychopath, as set out by founding father Hervey Cleckley, the PCLR and other clinical measures were themselves behaving rather oddly. Over the years, Lilienfeld realized, the diagnostic spotlight had widened, initially focused on the personality traits that underpinned the disorder. The emphasis now seemed to be as much, if not more, on antisocial acts. The psychopath circus had gotten stuck in the mud of forensics. As a case in point, Lilienfeld and Andrews cited fearlessness. In his original manifesto back in 1941, Cleckley had contended that low anxiety levels constituted one of the psychopath's true calling cards, a cardinal feature of the syndrome. Yet where, precisely, did that show up in the fabric of the PCLR? Behind such omissions, Lilienfeld detected a major theoretical fault line developing between the ways different sectors of the clinical and research fraternities were coming to view psychopathy, an old-school divide between two analytical traditions, between qualitative psychological means and quantitative behavioral ends. Two camps, it appeared, had crept out of the epistemological woodwork. In one were the Cleckleyites, whose main area of interest lay in the undercoat of personality. In the other were ensconced the behaviorists, beholden to DSM and the gospel of ASPD, who tended, in contrast, to focus on the criminal record. Such a schism, needless to say, was conducive to neither coherent empirical inquiry nor diagnostic consensus. An individual who, on the one hand, possessed all the necessary requirements of the psychopathic personality, but who didn't, on the other, partake in recurrent antisocial behavior, one of Mullen-Sweet's subclinical variety, for example, would be endorsed as a psychopath by advocates of the personality-based approach. But that same individual would, Lilienfeld and Andrews discerned, be turned smartly away at the door by their behaviorist actions speak louder than words opposite numbers. And the dynamic cut both ways. As we saw with Ian and Jimmy, not everyone who engages in habitual criminal activity is a psychopath. It's just a small minority, in fact. Something needed to be done to assimilate the rival frameworks, to bring these yawningly different perspectives into alignment. And Lilienfeld and Andrews had the answer. The Psychopathic Personality Inventory, PPI for short, consists of 187 questions. It's not exactly the snappiest questionnaire in the world, but then again, the nature of its subject matter isn't snappy either. 8 separate personality dimensions converge in this psychometric behemoth, making it one of the most comprehensive tests of psychopathy yet devised. Interestingly, our old friend factor analysis uncovers a familiar pattern. These 8 independent satellite states of the psychopathic personality, Machiavellian egocentricity, ME, impulsive nonconformity, IN, blame externalization, BE, carefree non-planfulness, CN, fearlessness, F, social potency, SOP, stress immunity, STI, and cold-heartedness, C, divide and reform along these 3 superordinate axes. 1, self-centered impulsivity, ME plus IN plus BE plus CN. 2, fearless dominance, SOP plus F plus STI, 3, cold-heartedness, C, to reveal in the statistical residue, once the mathematical dust clouds have settled, the structural DNA of pure, unadulterated psychopathy. This was the genome that Cleckley had originally sequenced, untarnished by time, unsullied by counts of transgression. And anyone, pretty much, could prove a positive match. The tequila was flowing. And so, as we hoover up the tacos, is Lilienfeld, as he explains what it really means in terms of the nuclei of core personality to be deemed to be a psychopath. He recounts the empirical rationale behind the development of the PPI. The problem at the time with the existing measures of the syndrome was that most of them had been honed on criminal or delinquent populations. Yet we know that people with psychopathic traits function perfectly well on the outside, and that some of them are extremely successful. Ruthlessness, mental toughness, charisma, focus, persuasiveness, and coolness under pressure are qualities, so to speak, that separate the men from the boys, pretty much across the board. So somehow we had to bridge the gap between the incarcerated forensic psychopaths and their elite, high-functioning counterparts. The high road through psychopathy was well established, but what about the low road? We reasoned that the psychopathy was on a spectrum, and it goes without saying that some of us will be high on some traits, but not on others. You and I could post the same overall score on the PPI, yet our profiles with regard to the 8 constituent dimensions could be completely different. You might be high on carefree non-planfulness, but correspondingly low on cold-heartedness. Whereas for me, it might be the opposite. Lilienfeld's notion of psychopathy being on a spectrum makes a good deal of sense. If psychopathy is conceptualized as an extension of normal personality, then it follows logically that psychopathy itself must be scalar, and that more or less of it in any given context might confer considerable advantages. Such a premise is not without precedent in the annals of mental dysfunction, if indeed psychopathy is dysfunctional, given its benefit under certain conditions. The autistic spectrum, for instance, refers to a continuum of abnormality in social interaction and communication, ranging from severe impairments at the deep end, those who are silent, mentally disabled, and locked into stereotypical behaviors such as head rolling or body rocking, for example, to mild interference at the shallow end. High-functioning individuals with active but distinctly odd interpersonal strategies, narrowly focused interests, and an undue preoccupation with sameness, rules, and ritual. Less familiar, perhaps, but equally pertinent, is the schizophrenic spectrum. Research on the construct of schizotypy suggests that psychotic experiences of one form or another, usually of the harmless and non-distressing variety, are relatively common among the general population, and that rather than being seen as a unitary condition, you've either got it or you haven't, schizophrenia should be viewed as a dimensional disorder with arbitrary cutoffs between normal, odd, and ill. Within this framework, the symptoms of schizotypal personality disorder, odd beliefs, bizarre speech patterns, eccentric interpersonal style, are very much construed as the nursery slopes of the central schizophrenia massif. Exactly as with psychopathy, at low to medium altitudes, the disorder is perfectly manageable, beneficial even in some contexts. The link between schizotypy and creativity is well established. But above and beyond the snow line, conditions get ever more hazardous. Such an approach to the conundrum of mental disorder has an intuitive, common-sense appeal. The nagging supposition that we're all just a little bit bonkers is a difficult one to ignore. Yet when it comes to psychopathy and the dimensional denouement of a psychopathic spectrum, Scott Lilienfeld certainly hasn't had things entirely his own way. There are those who take issue with his sliding scale solution and have evidence of their own to throw at it. Foremost among them is a man named Joseph Newman. What you don't know can't hurt you. Joe Newman is professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an hour in his office is like sitting in a psychological wind tunnel, like a whitewater raft ride through the rapids of cognitive science. For the better part of 30 years now, Newman has been in and out of some of the toughest prisons in the Midwest. Not, of course, as an inmate, but as one of the world's most intrepid researchers, working with psychopaths high above the snow line of dysfunction. Though long since acclimated to the harsh, unforgiving conditions, he concedes there are times, even now, when it all gets a little bit hairy. He recalls, for example, an incident a few years back with a guy who scored 40 on the PCLR. That, if you recall, is the maximum you can get, and it's rare. The guy was a pure psychopath. Usually there's a point in the interview where we like to push people a little bit, Newman tells me. You know, challenge them, gauge their reaction. But when we did that with this fella, and he was a really nice guy up until then, charming, funny, big personality, he got this kind of cold, derelict look in his eyes. Difficult to describe, but you know it when you see it, which just seemed to say, back off. And you know what? We did. He scared the absolute shit out of us. Newman, by his own admission, sometimes gets that look in his own eyes. He stops short of saying that it takes one to know one. But growing up as a kid on the mean streets of New York, he's had knives and guns and the whole nine yards pulled on him. Without a trace of irony, he's grateful, he says. It was a taste of things to come in academia. Newman is more abstemious than most when it comes to the selection criteria for a psychopath. My main concern is that the label of psychopath is applied too liberally and without sufficient understanding of the key elements, he purrs in a soft, almost apologetic tone. As a result, the doors are thrown open to pretty much anyone, and the term is often applied to ordinary criminals and sex offenders whose behavior may reflect primarily social factors or other emotional problems that are more responsive to treatment than psychopathy. Similarly, he's more than amenable to the idea of psychopaths coexisting outside the criminal firmament, often doing very well for themselves in professions that might otherwise come as a surprise to those less well-versed in the building blocks of the psychopathic personality, as surgeons, lawyers, and corporate head honchos, for example. The combination of low-risk aversion and lack of guilt or remorse, the two central pillars of psychopathy, he elucidates, may lead, depending on circumstances, to a successful career in either crime or business, sometimes both. So, no problems there. But where Newman does go against the grain is when it comes to the underlying cause or etiology of the disorder. Conventional theoretical wisdom holds that psychopaths are incapable of experiencing fear, empathy, and a host of other emotions, which anesthetizes their social cognition, and which in turn renders them commensurably incapable of countenancing such feelings in those they come into contact with. This position, taken by, among others, fellow psychopaths R. James Blair, implicates neural dysfunction, specifically in relation to the amygdala, the brain's CEO of emotion, plus a number of structures closely connected with it, the hippocampus, superior temporal sulcus, fusiform cortex, anterior cingulate, and orbitofrontal cortex, for instance, as the primary cause of the syndrome, as the core biological basis behind that industry-standard psychopathic dyad, the behavioral accompaniments of profound emotional impairment and repeated antisocial action. But Newman has other ideas. Far from believing that psychopaths are incapable of fear, that they're the emotionless void that the literature traditionally paints them as, he proposes instead that actually they just don't notice it. Imagine, for instance, that you're an arachnophobe and the mere thought of anything with eight legs sends you into a cold sweat. Such being the case, a tarantula might, for all you know, be dangling a few centimeters above your head right at this very moment. But if you don't know it's there, you won't be afraid of it, will you? In your brain, it just doesn't exist. In an ingenious experiment, Newman demonstrated that this might well be the story with psychopaths. Not just with spiders, but with most things. They don't feel distress or notice such emotion in others, because when they focus on a task that promises immediate reward, they screen everything irrelevant out. They get emotional tunnel vision. He and his co-workers presented a group of psychopaths and non-psychopaths with a series of mislabeled images. Their task, a favorite among cognitive psychologists, especially those interested in the mechanisms underlying attention, seems simple enough. Name the picture while ignoring the incongruent word, against the clock over a series of consecutive trials. Most people, in fact, find this a tad tricky. The explicit instruction to name the focal image conflicts with the urge to read the discrepant word, a juddering of the gears that leads to hesitation. This hesitation, or Stroop interference, as it's known, after J.R. Stroop, the man who came up with the original paradigm in 1935, is a measure of attentional focus. The faster you are, the narrower your attention spotlight. The slower you are, the wider the arc of the beam. If Newman's theory was to cut any ice, and psychopaths really did suffer from the kind of information processing deficit or talent that he was talking about, then it didn't take a rocket scientist to work out what should happen. They should be faster at naming the pictures than the non-psychopaths. They should zone in exclusively on the particular task at hand. The results of the study couldn't have turned out better. Time and again, Newman found that while the non-psychopathic volunteers were completely undone by the discrepant picture word pairings, taking longer to name the images, the psychopaths, in contrast, sailed through the task, pretty much oblivious to the jarring inconsistencies. What's more, and this is where things start to get a little sticky for Scott Lilienfeld and the psychopathic spectrum, Newman has detected an anomaly in the data. An abrupt discontinuity in response patterns once a critical threshold is reached. Everyone performs about the same, encounters the same degree of difficulty with such tasks on the lower slopes of the PCLR. But as soon as you hit psychopathy's clinical base camp, a score of 28 to 30, the dynamic dramatically changes. Indigenous populations at these rarer, higher altitudes suddenly find it easy. They just don't seem to process the glaring peripheral cues that, to everyone else, appear obvious. And it's not that they're immune to them. Far from it. In a separate study, Newman and his colleagues presented psychopaths and non-psychopaths with a series of letter strings on a computer screen. Some of them were red, and some of them were green. And some of them were downright painful. Volunteers were told that following the random display of an arbitrary number of reds, they'd receive an electric shock. As expected, when their attention was cued away from the prospect of shock, i.e., when they were asked to state whether the letters appeared in upper or lower case, the psychopaths showed considerably less anxiety than the non-psychopaths. But incredibly, when the prospect of shock was made salient, i.e., when volunteers were explicitly asked to state what colors the letters appeared in, red or green, the trend, as Newman and his co-authors predicted, reversed. This time, it was actually the psychopaths who became more agitated. People think psychopaths are just callous and without fear, he says, but there is definitely something more going on. When emotions are their primary focus, we've seen that psychopathic individuals show a normal emotional response. But when focused on something else, they become insensitive to emotions entirely. With a disconnect in response sets showing up at precisely the point on the PCLR that things get clinical, the mystery as to what, precisely, psychopathy really is, whether it lies on a continuum or is a completely separate disorder, suddenly deepens. Is psychopathy just a matter of degree, or are the big boys in a league of their own? One small step, one giant leap. It's reasonable to assume that the answer to such a question should, by its very nature, be black and white. That is, if psychopathy is on a continuum, then the trajectory from low to high, from Mother Teresa to John Wayne Gacy, must be linear and the road to moral weightlessness smooth. And if not, not. You get the kind of precipitous increments and data patterns observed by Joe Newman. But actually, as anyone who has ever played the lottery will tell you, it's not that simple. The six winning numbers are certainly on a continuum of 1 through 6. But the size of your winnings, from $1,000 to a $1 million jackpot, is a different story entirely. The function is exponential, and the relationship between the numbers on a continuum on the one hand and how they convert, quite literally in this case, to real-life currency on the other, is all about probabilities. The chances of snaring all six numbers, 1 in 13,983,816, do not diverge from the chances of snaring 5, 1 in 55,492, by the same degree that 5 diverges from 4, 1 in 1,033, not by a long way. And so, whereas on one level things progress predictably, what they boil down to in a parallel mathematical universe doesn't. What they map onto takes on a life of its own. Back at the restaurant, I put my theory to Scott Lilienfeld, that actually both he and Joe Newman might be right. Psychopathy might well be on a spectrum, but at the sharp, psychopathic business end of it, something ineffably stark seems to happen. A switch just seems to flip. I certainly think that's one way of reconciling the two perspectives, he reflects. And it's undoubtedly the case that those at the extreme end of many distributions seem to run on a different kind of gas from everyone else. But it also depends on your starting point, whether you view psychopathy predominantly as a personality predisposition or as an information processing disorder, whether you want to deal in cognitive deficits or variations in temperament. You can see it in the language, in the terminology used, disorder, deficit, predisposition, variation. It would be interesting to hear what Joe has to say. Have you put it to him? I hadn't. But not long afterward, I did. Is it possible, I asked Newman, that the further along the psychopathic spectrum one gets, assuming such a thing exists, the more you start, neurologically speaking, to see gradual changes occurring? Say, differences in the brain's attentional mechanisms or reward systems, which, the more psychopathic an individual is, becomes increasingly laser-like in their focus, increasingly primed for immediate gratification? And that although performance in the PPI or PCLR may be linear, the way that performance manifests itself in low-level brain activity, especially at very high scores, might instead be rather different? That it might in fact be spectacularly exponential? His eyes narrowed. The wily old gunslinger was in no mood for games. Sure, he said, it's possible. But the clinical cutoff on the PCLR is 30, and that in the lab, coincidentally or otherwise, is also the point at which most of the empirical shit hits the low-level cognitive fan. He smiled and poured some coffee. At any rate, he said, it doesn't really matter which way up you hold it. A clinical psychopath is a pretty distinct specimen. Either way, they're different, right? Chapter 3. Carpe Noctem. I have given suck and know how tender 'tis to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out, had I so sworn as you have done to this. Lady Macbeth, on hearing that her husband plans to proceed no further with the murder of King Duncan. The Devil and the Deep Blue Sea. On March 13, 1841, the William Brown set sail from Liverpool, bound for Philadelphia. 5 weeks into the voyage, on the night of April 19th, the vessel struck an iceberg 250 miles off the coast of Newfoundland and began to sink rapidly. Over 30 passengers and crew, still dressed in their nightclothes, commandeered a longboat built to hold just 7. With a storm looming and icy Atlantic rain already beginning to fall, it soon became apparent to First Mate Francis Rhodes that the longboat would have to be lightened were anyone to survive. The same thought had occurred to the captain, George L. Harris, who had taken to an accompanying jolly boat along with a handful of others. But he prayed for deliverance from another, more palatable source. "I know what you'll have to do," he confided to Rhodes. "Don't speak of that now. Let it be a last resort." The following morning, he sailed for Nova Scotia, leaving the hapless, foundering longboat to its fate. On the day of the 20th and on into the night, conditions worsened and the waves began to build. The boat sprang a leak and, despite frantic bailing, began to take on water. The situation was hopeless, and so at 10 o'clock on the night of April 20th, a momentous decision was taken. Some individuals would have to be put to the sword. Such an action, reasoned Rhodes, would not be unjust to those who went over the side, for they would surely have perished anyway. But if, on the other hand, he deigned to take no action, he would be responsible for the deaths of those whom he could have saved. Unsurprisingly, not all of the assembly concurred with Rhodes' conclusions. The dissenters contended that if no action was taken and everyone drowned as a result, then no one would be responsible for the deaths. In contrast, they argued, if he endeavored to save some of the party at the expense of even one other, he could only do so through the active taking of life, and would end his days, and quite possibly everyone else's, as a murderer. That, by far, would constitute the greater evil. Unmoved by the charge, Rhodes stuck to his guns. Since their only hope of survival depended upon staying afloat, not to mention, in addition, a Herculean feat of oarsmanship, the situation as it stood was untenable, he countered. Something or someone had to give. "Help me, God. Men, go to work," Rhodes cried out to the deckhands as he and fellow crew member Alexander Holmes set about the grisly task of casting people off into the tumultuous, inky cauldron of the North Atlantic. At first, the other seamen did nothing, prompting a second exhortation from Rhodes. "Men, you must go to work or we shall all perish." The death tally started to rise. All 14 of the male passengers were sacrificed, including 2 that were found to be hiding. Those who remained were just 2 married men and a boy, plus all but 2 of the women, the sisters of a man who'd previously gone over the side and who chose voluntarily to join him. The survivors were rescued by a trawler bound for Le Havre, and when at last they arrived in Philadelphia, they filed a lawsuit with the district attorney. On April 13, 1842, almost a year to the day since he'd cheated the icy Atlantic, able seaman Alexander Holmes stood trial on a charge of murder. He was the only crew member they could find in Philadelphia and was the only one to ever be indicted for his actions. If you had been on the jury, how would you have viewed the case? Before you answer, let me tell you why I'm asking. A couple of years ago, I presented this dilemma to a group of male undergraduates, half of whom scored high on the PPI, and half of whom scored low. Each was given 3 minutes deliberation time in which to mull the problem over. Then each student submitted his verdict anonymously in a sealed envelope. I wanted to know if the difference in PPI scores would have a bearing on what they decided. It didn't take me long to find out. Of the 20 volunteers who scored low on the PPI, only 1 reached a verdict within the allotted time. The others were still deliberating. But of the 20 volunteers at the other end of the scale, it was a different story entirely. Without exception, all of them had made up their minds, and the results were unanimous. Holmes was free to walk. Thinking outside the group. If you're trying to get your bearings inside this ethical hall of mirrors, don't panic. The good news is that you're obviously not a psychopath. In actual fact, on April 23, 1842, 10 days after the trial first opened, it took 16 hours for the jury to return a verdict, almost as long as Holmes had spent in the water. Guilty he might have been, of manslaughter, that is, not murder, but under such psychological G-force, that right and wrong had imploded under the pressure, becoming morally indistinguishable from each other. The judge handed Holmes a token 6-month sentence plus a $20 fine. In contrast, consider the following case as reported in the Daily Telegraph back in 2007. Two police community support officers did not intervene to stop a 10-year-old boy from drowning because they were not trained to deal with the incident, a senior police officer said today. The officers stood at the edge of a pond at a Wigan beauty spot as Jordan Lyon got into trouble while trying to rescue his 8-year-old stepsister. Two fishermen in their 60s jumped in and managed to save the girl, but the officers, who arrived at the scene shortly afterwards, did not attempt a rescue, deciding to wait until trained officers arrived. At the inquest into his death today, the boy's distraught parents demanded to know why more effort was not made to save their son. His stepfather said, "You don't have to be trained to jump in after a drowning child." At first glance, this case and that of able seaman Alexander Holmes have little in common. In fact, they appear to be polar opposites. The former revolves around an extraordinary reluctance to preserve life. The latter, around a curious ambivalence towards saving it. Yet look a little closer, and striking similarities emerge. In both scenarios, for instance, it's the breaking of rules that's the problem. In the Jordan Lyon affair, the officers were paralyzed by a code of conduct, an all-consuming requirement to toe the party line. Like performing SEALs, they had been trained beyond their instincts. Trained, you might say, to eschew any action for which they had not been trained. In the William Brown tragedy, the rules were more deeply encoded. They were more functional and more ethically hygienic. Yet they were, one could argue, as some quite vehemently did, no less detrimental to the exigencies of the moment. The seamen, so to speak, were in exactly the same boat as the police officers, caught in the moral crosshairs of a bleak humanitarian knife edge. They had to act quickly, decisively, and with manifest disregard for the consequences of their actions. Some did it better than others. Yet alongside the challenge to our existential comfort zones, these two accounts also conceal, deep within the lining of their tragedies, a rather odd paradox. The fact that conformity is built into our brains is about as nailed down an evolutionary certainty as you can get. When a herd animal is threatened by a predator, what does it do? It huddles closer to the group. As individual salience decreases, chances of survival increase. This is just as true in humans as it is in other species. Streaming behind our supersonic, turbocharged brains are ancient Darwinian vapor trails stretching all the way back to the brutal, blood-soaked killing fields of prehistory. In an experiment, for instance, that hitched the latest in social networking to its earliest biological origins, social psychologist Vladas Griskovicius, then at Arizona State University, and his co-workers found in 2006 that when users of an internet chat room are made to feel under threat, they show signs of sticking together. Their views display convergence, and they become more likely to conform to the attitudes and opinions of others in the forum. But there are clearly times when the opposite is true, when the ability to break free of social convention, to think outside the group, can also be a lifesaver, both literally and metaphorically. In 1952, the sociologist William H. White coined the term groupthink to conceptualize the mechanism by which tightly knit groups cut off from outside influence rapidly converge on normatively correct positions, becoming, as they do, institutionally impervious to criticism, indifferent to out-group position, averse to in-group dissent, and ever more confident of their own unimpeachable rectitude. The psychologist Irving Janis, who conducted much of the empirical work on the phenomenon, describes the process as a mode of thinking that people engage in when they are deeply involved in a cohesive in-group, when the members' strivings for unanimity override their motivation to realistically appraise alternative courses of action. It's not exactly conducive to good decision-making. As a case in point, take the Space Shuttle Challenger fiasco. Under considerable political pressure to get things underway, Congress at the time was seeking a large slice of revenue in furtherance of the space program, and a series of problems had already delayed the launch. Scientists and engineers at NASA appeared systemically immune to concerns raised by a coworker just 24 hours before liftoff over the O-rings in the booster rockets. Though a string of conference calls had specifically been convened to discuss the problem in detail, the decision, incomprehensible in hindsight, was made to press on. The goal, after all, was to get this show on the road. In the event, it proved disastrous. Inquests revealed, as the villains of the piece, not just the O-rings, but another more viral, more insidiously carcinogenic culprit, a musty, asphyxiating psychology. The Rogers Commission, a dedicated task force set up by then-President Ronald Reagan to investigate the accident, confirmed the nagging, unspoken fears of social psychologists the world over, that NASA's organizational culture and decision-making processes had played a significant role in the lead-up to the tragedy. Pressure to conform, discounted warnings, sense of invulnerability, it was all there, plain as day. So is the capacity to stand alone, to play by one's own rules outside the normative safe haven of society, also hardwired? There's evidence to suggest that it is, and that a fearless, untroubled minority has evolved within our midst.
A fearless, untroubled minority has evolved within our midst. Context of white supremacy. That will do it for this week. We are in Chapter 3. That's where we'll pick up at for next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Do not wait until the last minute. Emmy should be with us, Red Nevada, Roz, Mr. Demery 4. Line should be open. I'll look for other hands if other people have commentary as well. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just have actually just two quick notes. The first one, I thought it was interesting how when he was, when we first started the segment, when he was speaking about Joe Newman, he was saying, he was describing basically how he had spoken to different inmates, and he had said that, you know, he's been in and out of jail or in and out of different correctional facilities, but of course not as a criminal. And so I just thought that that was kind of funny that, you know, even it's almost like, you know, if I'm assuming this is a white man, and it would just be infathomable for him to be in jail when I know, like, on different shows on the cows, there have been white people who have been arrested who were in like during the 60s, they were in these like anti-commun or
anti-establishment, basically, type of organizations. And then they've been to, you know, done different crimes and then gone on to be successful people. The other thing was, I just lost it. But I guess the last thing that I wanted to comment on was the story about the police officers, and they didn't save the child who was drowning because they weren't trained to. And that just made me think about, like, you know, the contemporary setting, especially here in the United States, of, you know, police officers, how they always say they need more training to do their job. So I also just thought that was interesting. I guess that's all I had to share. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Red in Nevada. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I think there's an
assumption. Oh, we could hear you. Now your volume dropped. Not hearing you, Emmy. Your audio level dropped. Let's see. We're not hearing you, Emmy. We are not hearing you. Your audio level dropped very, very low. Are you able to hear us? Let's try it again. Can you hear us, Emmy?
I can.
Grand.
Hello. Grand. I'm so sorry. I apologize about that. Okay. I don't think there's enough, and perhaps there is, evidence to suggest that it's all genetic or with some type of, like, physical malfunction that is having these individuals not able to process sensory information or emotional information, like through their amygdala in whatever type of way. They run fMRIs and EEGs and whatever and came up to some type of conclusion. But I think that, I mean, at least for myself, I'm just going to put on the table that it's quite possible that these individuals are making a choice, that perhaps this isn't just some kind of malfunction, physiological malfunction that's just having this occur, that who says that you can't do that? Like, from a very early age, make a choice that you just don't care. People do different things for different reasons. And, you know, if you, and it doesn't take much to develop an association between being, say, like a bully or doing something and, like, not really caring how it affects another person and watching what happens, and then that develops a response. You make the association, you do it again, you continue to do it, you kill a cat, next thing you know, you know, thinking about killing people. And you just do that. And once you, like, because there's this air. So, you know, you're talking to these individuals that are in prison, and, you know, they're questioning, they're all excited. Ooh, what makes you so mysterious? And, like, and the people are just like, I do whatever I want to do when I want to do it, and I really don't care. Like, there's an assumption that all people value freedom, so-called freedom, the same way. That, and it's quite possible, there's enough evidence to suggest that if you continue to make a choice, you do develop a habit. That habit can become physiological at some level, like you develop certain pathways in the brain more than you develop other pathways in the brain. So by the time this person is an adult and have committed murders and all this other kind of stuff, and you observe their physiology, you're seeing that, but it doesn't mean that person didn't make a choice. That's really the only thing that I wanted to say, that I think there's too much of a push to say that this is... Hello?
Yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. I got scared that the phone did the weird thing again, but that is not a choice, and that it's all, you know, just random. These certain people just happen to become psychopaths for whatever reason, and I think there's enough evidence to suggest that maybe they chose it. Thank you.
Dig it. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you'd like to share. Yes, sir.
Yes. Can I be heard? Okay. Thank you. Great assessments, everyone, so far. I wanted to start on page 59, where Mr. Dutton writes, and the dynamic cuts both ways, as we saw with Ian and Jimmy. Not everyone who engages in habitual criminal activity is a psychopath. It's just a small minority. In fact, something needed to be done to assimilate the rival frameworks to bring these yawningly different perspectives into alignment. And he's done this a couple times where he'll talk about psychopathy and then he'll say, well, it's only a small number of them. It's only a small number. It's only a minority. But what we're finding is it's all pervasive and it's everywhere. And more importantly, the people that are most in control of these different institutions, jobs, environments, are the people who are most psychopathic. So to me, he's trying to minimize what is the white norm. So in other words, like you look at when you even just take the Harvey Weinstein situation, we're seeing that sexual deviance is the norm. It's white people's norm. And they're so successful at living by a code that this has been hidden for 100 years. I saw an article talking about Charlie Chaplin raping boys. So like they're like this Hollywood thing is at least 100 years old. So it is something that's all pervasive, but they try to make it seem as if it's an anomaly, even though the records show, publicly speaking, with all of this stuff coming out back to back to back to back to back, and every day somebody else new is accusing someone else, that it is all pervasive. It's not just a couple of them. It's not just the minority, unless you're talking about the white minority. And when I say that, the global white minority, not just one or two whites, but all whites. I wanted to also get to, there was a section. Okay. Oh, yes. Page 63, where he writes, Newman, by his own admission, sometimes gets that look in his own eyes. He stops short of saying that it takes one to know one, but growing up as a kid on the mean streets of New York, he's had knives and guns the whole nine yards pulled on him. Without a trace of irony, he's grateful, he says. It was a taste of things to come in academia. So he's telling you right there from his own personal experience, even though he's a white man, that he's come across criminals all throughout academia. Who's in control of academia? White people. Who are they teaching? White people and non-white people. And what do we read in the papers? White teachers raping students left and right and doing all kinds of deviant things. So even in his own admission as a white man, he's experienced psychopathy just going through the educational process. And I found that to be quite telling that he, you know, he made that statement, but it's obviously true. The next section, let me make sure I don't lose my spot, was, oh, okay, I think we're coming up on it now. Oh, yes, here we go. Yes, it's page 74. So they write, at first glance, this case and that of Abel Seaman Alexander Holmes have little in common. In fact, they appear to be polar opposites. The former revolves around an extraordinary reluctance to preserve life, the latter around a curious ambivalence towards saving it. Yet look a little closer and striking similarities emerge. In both scenarios, for instance, it's the breaking of rules that's the problem. In Jordan, the Jordan Lyon affair, the officers were paralyzed by a code of conduct, an all-consuming requirement to toe the party line. Like performing SEALs, they had been trained beyond their instincts, trained, you might say, to eschew any action for which they had not been trained. And this has a dualistic dyad kind of thing that pops in my head. So when you look at white supremacy, they're trained, this minority has been trained to treat everybody who's not like them a certain way. And they live by that code no matter what, even if it means, in that case, letting children drown. For black people, we have been abused to the point that we are abused to not function outside of the reins of rules that they set for us. So the people who are doing things to counter the system and to destroy the system of white supremacy and replace it with justice are people who are willing to break the rules. And as he wrote here, we are people who choose not to eschew any action for which we had not been trained. So in other words, we're able to look beyond the boundaries of white supremacy, though we're less confused, so we have an understanding of it and what it means to be in a system of white supremacy. We still are the people who are able to think and say that even though these are the current rules, those rules need to be abolished and a new system and new rules need to be set up and assessed. So it shows you how white people function holistically to a point where they function with the code that's so all pervasive that there's no humanity for the people who are not in their group, the non-white people, and then how their victims are beaten and dominated into a place where they only do what they've been trained to do, including self-abuse, anti-blackness, and all of the other things that we as a group do to support the system of white supremacy, whether consciously or unconsciously. This is on page 76. This is the last part where he wrote, The Rogers Commission, a dedicated task force set up by then-President Ronald Reagan to investigate the accident, confirmed the nagging, unspoken fears of social psychologists the world over that NASA's organizational structures and culture and decision-making processes had played a significant role in the lead-up to the tragedy. Pressure to conform, discounted warnings, sense of invulnerability, it was all there, plain as day. So it says, so the capacity to stand alone, to play by one's own rules outside the normative safe haven of society, is that also hardwired? There's evidence to suggest that it is, and that a fearless, like you said, Gus, at the beginning, untroubled minority has evolved within our midst. That is white supremacy. That is the movie They Live. They've evolved within our presence. We think of them as human because they walk on two legs, and you know, some of us sadly choose to procreate with them, but ultimately they're not human, and they have gotten us psychologically trained to let them be in control, and they're willing to make decisions that affect everyone negatively except those people who are in control. So we have to really, this book is really profound in exposing the way that white people function collectively and individually, and we can learn a lot as far as trying to develop new ways of countering their psychotic machinations. Thank you. I'll meet my line.
Indeed. Appreciate that, Roz. I thought even from the first audio segment, I thought that was an important point that you raised as well about how this small minority that has evolved on the planet, they have modeled a lot of barbaric and incorrect behaviors, and all of us get contaminated. I mean, this is what they got on television. This, in my view, the wisdom of psychopath might explain why a television program like The Walking Dead is so celebrated, and just that way of functioning. I think you were saying being that model of being slick, you go up to someone and you're nice, and then you carry out whatever caper you're going to do. That gets modeled all the time, where white people are the ones carrying out the caper. They brag about that, boast about that, being slick and getting over on somebody. Let me make sure I didn't miss any of the folks who had a hand up. Graham, do not wait till the last minute. If you do have comments, you want to make sure you get in if we miss somebody who has not spoken. Some of the notes that I took on the second audio segment, when he says, he's talking about one of his white, presumably white colleagues, Joe Newman. He says this guy grew up in New York and whatever. He says later on, Newman is the guy who interviewed this psychopath in prison. The guy gave him the look that said back off. So he did. He scared him to death. He says Newman, without a trace of irony, he's grateful. He says it was a taste of things to come in the academy. And this is contrasting growing up in the tough streets of New York. We encountered all this. I think Roz touched on this. I think that's extremely important. Just consistently, violence, everything gets compared to violence, brutality in some form. Even if we're talking about the academy, this is supposed to be learning, research, asking questions. No, this gets compared to some sort of street brawl and pulling a knife out on somebody and mugging someone. Like, that is white culture, the white mentality. And in fact, I remember it was a white person. They said, this was years ago, we used to repeat this phrase all the time, violence solves everything. I have seen that mentality with regards to whites. Most of the time, they don't boil it down so succinctly, but that is generally how the racist mind operates. Violence solves everything. If I have to pick a concept to relate to someone else, violence. I know that's something that we can relate to. Violence. Continuing. With the very next paragraph, he says, Newman is more abstemious than most when it comes to the selection criteria for a psychopath. And I thought that was important. Number one, I didn't know what abstemious meant, not self-indulgent, especially when eating and drinking. New word. And then I also thought, with regards to people now saying Donald Trump, it's been fashionable for a year or so for people to say that he is a psychopath. And a lot of folks have pushed back and said, well, we're just kind of throwing this word around. And I think a lot of people don't have a definition. What does this term mean? This is a, you know, serious clinical term, that sort of thing. I also thought that he might even take issue with the folks on this broadcast who have insisted that racist man, racist woman, racist child collectively function as psychopaths. Might take issue with that. And that is ridiculous. And that's the most absurd thing. I could easily see how that would happen as well. I would just say, look at the evidence worldwide, historically. Look at their body of work. look back at that definition in terms of how psychopaths function. And especially in my view, keeping in mind that whites, they frequently brag, and the statues that they're talking about everywhere, they brag about acts of racism against black people in particular, non-white people on the whole. Continuing, just as I said, paying attention to the use of terms where he then comes back later on to refer to the Newman character, again, one of his colleagues, as a gunslinger. I thought we were talking about an academic person. I thought we were talking about someone who's at Oxford, for God's sake. No, they're a gunslinger. We're talking about somebody who's, you know, got a mouthful of tobacco and is spitting in a spittoon and ready to challenge someone to a duel, a la Ben Tillman that we heard from the South Carolina's former governor. I just forgot the title of his book, Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy. But yeah, the gunslinger. And I hear that all the time, where that's like a badge of honor to describe another white person, someone as a risk taker, or they are aggressive. This is a gunslinger. Again, worshiping killers, worshiping violence, lethal violence, American Sniper. The coffee came up in there where they were having all these discussions about violence and killing and psychopaths over coffee. Welsing moment. Continuing on into chapter 3. I had to stop the Latin carpe noctem. It's supposed to be kind of a play on carpe diem, seize the day, popular Latin phrase. They invoke it all the time. Seize the night. Again, if we're talking about psychopathy and psychosis, darkness being associated with something vile, something bad, something evil. Continuing. Let's see. That first scenario that he gives about the ship situation, and, you know, they conclude violence solves everything. We'll just have to kill some of the people. We got too many folks. We're not going to make it. Reminded me of the Zong. We talked about that. That was, I believe, from The Half Has Never Been Told that we read last year, but it mentioned the book The Zong, about a slave ship that left Liverpool, no less, and they did not have enough water. They missed their target. I think they were trying to land in Jamaica. They missed their target, and to solve their problem, they did the same thing. We ran out. We're not going to have enough water to ration it out and what have you, so we'll just start tossing the niggers overboard. And this was their cargo. This is their money, but we'll just start tossing the niggers overboard. This seems common. Violence solves everything. And I think the same thing in the situation with the Zong, a book that we talked about last year, that situation, I think they found out that they might not have had to do this either, that, you know, they could have rationed water. And I think even some of the victims said that they would be willing to fast and go without food or water to just see how long that they could make it. And this didn't satisfy the whites in charge. No, no, no. We don't want you to fast. We'd rather kill some folks and throw you overboard and watch the sharks eat you. And then I think they did go to court, and they nobody was criminally prosecuted. And I think even the white enslaver who owned the ship got money. He was able to file an insurance claim, and I think he won his case from my memory of reading the book The Zong. And again, I'll just get that last sentence in. An untroubled minority has evolved within our midst. It cannot be emphasized enough, the work of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. We are talking about a tiny minority of the global population that is functioning in an extraordinarily violent, terroristic way towards the majority of the non-white population on the planet. That's what we have. It fits exactly, in my opinion. I could be in error. If we have other folks who have any comments they want to get in before we wrap up, we have about 6-7 minutes. See our former narrator, Mel. You should be with us if you had commentary.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I was not able to listen to the entire second audio segment because I am at, or actually the first, because I'm at work, so I've been listening in patches, actually. So I'm going to not be able to comment on everything, but the commentary that I've heard so far was really good. And I wanted to piggyback off of a point you just made and one which was made during the first segment. I think in the first segment, someone was saying that slaveholders might be under one definition called psychopaths, but that's not, it's obviously not an example probably being brought up in the book, but it's not typically an example people think of either. Well, people are not counter-racist. And, oh my goodness, sorry. And in the first part of the second audio segment, the word criminality is brought up. And even later on in this, about the same first part of the second reading, he brings up the term incarcerated forensic crime. And I'm thinking that just like slave masters might be considered psychopaths, I'm thinking a lot of people who would consider other people criminals might be psychopathic. And I'm thinking that because I've heard people refer to Colin Kaepernick as a criminal. There are people who sort of take stances against injustice. Martin Luther King say that, well, these people need to be thrown in jail. And I'm thinking to protest for your rights is not psychopathic, but to incarcerate anyone for trying to do that might be psychopathic. So his definition of not just psychopath, but criminal, and just piggybacking off that point. The second idea I was thinking about was that he did this in the first reading segment that we did last week, where he put the word businessman or corporate head honcho in between what appeared to be a utilitarian type of profession and maybe another necessary type of profession. And like I think this week he said surgeon, corporate head honcho, and then another profession I can't remember. And my issue with that is that psychopathic surgeons or head honchos, but a surgeon is a necessary thing. When you think about what a corporate head honcho or business, it's a holistic entity. It's money above everything. And that in and of itself has resulted in plenty of psychopathic incidents, I think. And that was, I guess, my final point, is that I'm noticing there's a great amount of stress on the definition of a psychopath and who fits this mode of who might be a psychopath, rather than psychopaths being the result of the things that they do. And I think that might be kind of troubling for me. Like, I don't need to know who is a psychopath. Well, it's important to think about who could be a psychopath ahead of time. But I think after they've done something psychopathic, it no longer needs to be discussed whether or not they're on the spectrum or if this was a one-off incident. They've done something at that point that's harmful. And I think if you're committing that sort of harm intentionally, knowledgeably, I feel like you go into a category of psychopath, whether you like it or not. I do feel like harm actually is being excessively ignored, the resulting harm of a psychopath. But that was all of my points. Sorry.
You said you feel like the harm of a psychopath, the harm that they do, is being ignored. How so? Oh, are you still with us, Mel? Do we have time to get that question in really quick?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? I'm in a moving vehicle.
Oh, right on. I'll be quick. You said that the harm that psychopaths conduct is being ignored. How so?
I feel like there's analysis being done into how everyday people, for instance, may be considered psychopaths. And I am picking up on that he is talking about some specific people would be considered like killers or harmful individuals. But when he focuses on the everyday person possibly being a psychopath or how various psychological tests have put them into and out of the category of psychopathy, I mean, though we all may be aware that there are everyday white supremacists who are psychopaths, I guess the result of the psychopathy is just not really being emphasized enough for me personally. But it could be something I'm just not picking up on. And as I said, it's out here. The first audio segment in its entirety, and I only heard patches of the second. I'm sorry if my point's already been stated.
All right. That makes sense. I guess if this makes sense with your analysis, I just neglected one. When he gave his chart of presidents and saying that all of the presidents, I guess, so this does not include President Obama or George Bush II, but everybody else, all qualified, they were all on the scale of psychopathy. And it ignores that a substantial chunk of these folks are enslavers. I think that might go to ignoring the harm, because it did seem, with the presidents I'm talking about, it seemed like William Clinton and JFK, these guys being psychopaths, it was almost presented in a humorous manner, like, oh, you would never think of that, ha ha ha, and then continuing, ignoring, well, Bill Clinton is accused of, with his psychopathy, of peddling drugs, then locking up a lot of black people. And you got, as I said, a whole lot of enslavers on this list. That's not really the focus and any of the damage that they did being in the White House and practicing psychopathy white supremacy. That might fall in line with what she's submitting, might not. But either way, you can put that down as another one where white psychopaths and their racist conduct is not being included in the text. Major, major pattern. Any last comment folks can get in? 30 seconds? Are we satisfied?
Yes. Yeah, I thought that was a great observation. I think what I'm gathering from what the previous caller said is because they're not focusing on the damage it does, it's not giving us a holistic picture on how white supremacy functions and how this mentality affects us globally. Also, I just wanted to say briefly, I was listening to another radio show a few weeks back, and the host had discussed the fact that there were three white psychologists that came out in different articles calling Donald Trump a psychopath, and that they had gotten such intimidation from the media and from the academia regarding this assessment that they gathered 27 other white psychologists to come together to write a book elucidating his psychopathy. Thank you. I'll mute my line. So that's less powerful white against the one most powerful white on the planet, Donald Trump. And in order to feel safe in speaking about his lunacy and his racist psychopathy, I should say, they had to get 27 less powerful whites together that were all psychologists. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Great timing. I just said that has been a major topic. In fact, I would be kind of surprised if Mr. Dutton has not been questioned about Donald Trump and whether or not he qualifies as a psychopath. I'm going to research on that for next week. And again, just to make the point that I said earlier, if the most powerful white people really didn't want Barack Obama to be president at any point during the past 8 years when he was in the White House, if they have the ability to get Donald Trump in the White House, I am extraordinarily confident if they didn't want him to be there, he would have been mopping floors or popping popcorn or whatever else other than being president and annoying a large number of whites for 8 years. I could be in error. We'll be back next Friday. We're in Chapter 3 of Kevin Dutton's The Wisdom of Psychopaths. Enjoying the text. Dr. Rasayan told us that there is a wonderful, wonderful nugget waiting for us at the end of the book. Just continue reading, and it just gets better as we roll. So we'll have to see. We'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. We'll catch up on news observations from the past week. I think we'll even have one more tidbit on Charles Manson on tomorrow's broadcast. If you have commentary you want to share, write in. We can include it, read it. We still have, I think, about 4 weeks before we get to the conclusion of this text. So you can drop an email if you have questions or just comments you want to add, untiljustice@gmail.com. Grand. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your Black Friday evening. If you are going to be out and about, remain safe. I would highly recommend remain sober. I posted an article from the Seattle Times today where a male, they didn't have a photo or anything, so I don't know. But they said a guy was nude, intoxicated, in his vehicle, having sexual intercourse, and crashed into a tree. That is your holiday weekend, quote unquote. That's why I say sobriety would be best. That's what you're going to have out. A whole lot of people are going to be drinking this weekend. A whole lot of whites are going to be super, super drunk this weekend. That's what's going to be out on the road, number one. And then two, there are probably going to be a lot of enforcement officials. They will certainly be looking for you if you are on the dark side. So I would say either stay in the house and or if you're going to be out and about, buckle up, be sober so that you can make tremendous decisions. You never know when you might have to make life-saving decisions. If you should be stopped by an enforcement official, they have been mentioned prominently as we've been talking about psychopaths. So I don't think you want to be under the influence and having to talk to save your life with a psychopath. Buckle up if you're going to be in a vehicle, driver, or passenger. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with white psychopaths, race soldiers. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.